call on to Newbridge.
Okay. Good morning, everyone. Welcome to our first high-tech meeting of 2019. Glad you all could be with us today. Appreciate your flexibility and rearranging the schedules for the year, but we have a very full agenda, as I'm sure you've probably noticed already. With that in mind, I'm sure there's going to be plenty of questions and discussion. So just as a reminder, if you're in the Adobe, to please use the hand-raising function. If you're only on the phone, just feel free to pipe in and remind us on your own, that you're on the phone, and we'll put you in the queue. At this point, I will officially call the meeting to order, starting with roll call. Carolyn Peterson?
I'm here. Good morning.
Good morning. Robert Wass?
Present. Good morning, everyone.
Good morning. Michael Adcock? Not yet. Christina Caraballo?
Good morning. I'm here.
Tina Esposito?
Present.
Cynthia Fisher?
Yes. Good morning.
Brad Gescheider?
Good morning.
Valerie Gray?
Good morning.
Anil Jain? I think he said he may be a little bit late. John Kansky?
I'm here.
Ken Kawamoto?
Here.
Stephen Lane?
Present.
Les Leonard?
I'm here.
Arian Malik?
Good morning.
Katie McComb?
Present.
Clem McDonald? Not yet. Okay. Aaron Meary?
Good morning, everyone.
Brett Oliver?
Good morning.
Good morning, Terry O'Malley?
Good morning.
Good morning, Raj Botwani?
Good morning.
Good morning. Steve Reedy?
Present.
Patrick Soon-Shong? Sasha Termott?
Present. Good morning.
Andy Trescott?
Present.
Cheryl Turney?
Cheryl's here.
Denise Webb? I do believe Denise is on. Kate Goodrich?
Yes, I'm present. Sorry.
Good morning.
Couldn't get the mute off.
That's okay. Do we have Kate on the line? Chesley Richards? Ram Sharam? And Lauren Thompson?
Good morning. I'm here.
Good morning. Just want to confirm we have Alex Markey from CMS.
I'm here.
Perfect. And from our ONC leadership team, we have myself, Seth Pavinsky, Elise Sweeney Anthony, Steve Posnack, Mike Lipinski, and Dr. Don Rucker. With that, I will turn it over to our national coordinator, Dr. Rucker, for a few opening remarks.
Okay, thanks. First of all, thanks everyone for attending. It's our first meeting of the year. Turns out to be virtual, I think, as folks know from the government funding issues earlier in the year. Today is a big meeting because we're going to really go over and give you an in-depth on all of the work on Title IV in the 21st Century Cures Act. So we released at HIMSS last week a proposed rule that implements the provisions around seamless and secure access, exchange, and use of electronic health information as required in CURES, and look forward to getting your input and feedback on that rule. The specifics of the rule, the somewhat specifics of the rule, are requiring secure APIs without special effort, which we really see as standards-based application programming interfaces. A number of reasonable necessary activities to do that. Exceptions to the prohibition on information blocking. The information blocking is banned under the law already. We're charged with the exceptions. And then some of the certification program steps that are needed. The basic things you're going to see then are the secure standardized API work, information blocking, the certification program. We've also put in request for information on what additional information would be needed for price transparency, which is a big, big national issue that comes up with patient access and control. The Cures Act, the rule, actually, when you look at it, pretty much maps exactly what Congress had as the three priorities for HITECH, which, as you remember, are interoperability, privacy/security, and then patient access. So I think we're pretty much on center point with that. I know there's also work on the angle. To come are the draft trusted exchange framework, and an area we're going to get into, not today, but in a short future meeting, some of the things around prior auth. Our burden report really identified prior auth as an issue. There's some very interesting things on the interaction of standards around prior auth and related things like clinical decision support. And there may be some opportunities to do some things there. So at any rate, thanks everybody in advance. And I'm going to turn it over to Alex Muggy from CMS, who's the Deputy Chief Health Informatics Officer. And Alex can talk about the companion CMS rule. Alex.
Great. Thanks, Don. And thanks, everyone, for having me here on the call today. I did just want to offer a few remarks on the CMS rule and its relation to the ONC rule. The two rules definitely take slightly different approaches to interoperability due to our different authorities and different target audiences, but I think we can agree that they both have the same end goal in mind. The CMS rule, which is has an extremely long title, but the shorthand is the Interoperability and Patient Access Proposed Rule. This rule touches on just about every entity that CMS regulates. We have policies in this rule for health plans, clinicians, hospitals, and post-acute care providers, so really running the gamut of what CMS oversees. We worked very closely with ONC on the development of this rule, and I think that demonstrated the way that the rules complement one another. Both rules have adopted the FHIR standard for interoperability, which was a critical move to support the API technology and CMS's enhanced focus on seamless data exchange. Our proposal for information blocking, I know this is really an area that the ONC rule is focused on, and this is an area where ONC has made a huge milestone by releasing their information blocking rule. We also have a small information blocking proposal in the CMS interoperability rule. And this was, you know, in part to demonstrate our commitment as a department to stop the practice of information blocking and really double down on our efforts to prevent that going forward. I know you all are not actually tasked with reviewing the CMS rule, but we did just want to offer this comparison and where some of the policies do overlap. I'm more than happy to address any follow-up questions that folks may have in a later meeting. I know you have a lot to cover today, so I won't take any more of your time, but please feel free to follow up if you have questions on the CMS rule or if there's anything that we can offer to help from our perspective and the work that you're doing here. And with that, I will just wrap up and hand it back to ONC.
Okay. Great. Thank you so much, Alex and Dr. Rucker. At this point, I will turn it over to our co-chairs, Carolyn and Robert, just for the review and approval from the December meeting minutes.
Thanks, Lauren. Good morning, everyone. It's great for us to be able to get together in the new year and to have our first meeting. We have quite an excellent agenda today. Two major items. First, we'll be reviewing the 21st Century Cures proposed rule overview and establishing task forces. And then we will have a presentation on the HITECH annual report draft review. Really great to see everyone. I will now ask that we approve the minutes of the December meeting. Something we need to do before we dig into our presentations. That those minutes were sent out in your
move package. Approval.
Second.
And could everyone who is in favor of approving the minutes please signify by saying aye?
Aye.
Aye.
And could everyone who is not in favor of approving the minutes please signify by saying no? Do we have any abstentions? All right. I think we have approved the minutes from the December meeting. I will now pass the mic to Robert for his remarks.
Oh, thank you, Caroline, and again, thanks to everyone for your patience and understanding as we dealt with the many changes at the beginning of the year for the meeting. As Caroline notes, we have a very full schedule, and our plan is to spend the bulk of the time on the 21st Century Cure proposed rule, but also it's equally important for the work that Caroline and Aaron did as co-chairs of the annual report draft review. So we have a scheduled time for public comment at 12:45 that we will try to honor as we have in the past to make sure that we are meeting our commitment to the public to have their period of time to comment. So we'll try to make sure that that stays at the 12:45 p.m. Time frame. And I look forward to a good meeting and hopefully look forward to seeing you all soon at our next face-to-face meeting.
Great. Thank you so much, Robert and Carolyn. At this point, I think we would just dive right into it. I know we are all anxious to get started, so I would like to turn it over to Lee Sweeney-Anthony, our Executive Director of Office of Policy within ONC. We're going to do a little bit of tag teaming between Elise and Mike Lipinski, who's the Director of our Regulatory Affairs Division, and then we will take a brief pause about halfway through to continue on to hear from Steve Posnack, who's our Executive Director of Office of Technology. With that, I will turn it over to Elise.
Thank you, Lauren, and thank you to everyone for joining us today. I know at least over here in D.C., we're in the midst of snow coming down, but many thanks to teleworking for us to be able to have the call today. So we're excited to share with you the 21st Century Cures Act, interoperability, information blocking, and the ONC Health IT Certification Program proposed rule. The proposed rule includes many policies that ONC has been working on and thinking through to support the access exchange and use of electronic health information for the benefit of the patient and the providers who serve them. If we can go to the next slide. As Lauren said, we have a lot that we are going to be presenting. This is actually the deck that we have used for the presentation at HIMSS. This disclaimer really applies to folks who might see this online because we do post the decks online. So we do want to note, you know, for the public or for those who review it, we encourage folks that to submit their comments online. So for all those who are listening from the public, please do submit any comments you have through the process that's noted in the proposed rule. I'd also note that the rule is currently on our website, which is healthit.gov/NPRM, and we expect it to be posted to the Federal Register shortly. Once the actual posting does occur, that's when the time frame for the public to respond to 60 days would start. So we will update our website accordingly as that goes forward. Next slide. So our agenda for today, as you can see, it's pretty packed. We'll talk a little bit later about the task forces that we expect to charge the high tech to look at around the someone's line is live if you guys want to mute out. Thank you. All right, so we will talk a little bit later about the task forces that we will charge the high tech with to look at some of the policies that are included in the rule. For now, we wanted to walk through the specific provisions that are in there so folks have a general kind of understanding of what we have included. As Lauren did note, there's a lot to go through. So we do have a little bit of time for questions, but we will also have the task forces starting up very quickly, and I think that's where you'll see a lot of the deep dive into questions that the high tech may have. All right, so next slide. All right, so just to talk a little bit about implementation of the 21st Century Cures Act and the work that we have underway. So what we've included, and these are also on our website, are some infographics or fact sheets that identify some of the things that are addressed through the rule that we've put together. And that includes everything from pediatrics, and we include some provisions related to the recommendations that Congress asked us to develop around supporting the pediatric care setting, as well as, we also include some certification criteria updates to support the interoperable movement of information related to pediatric care settings. 4002 focuses on the conditions of certification, and soon I'll turn it over to Mike to talk more about what those are. But the main thing I want folks to remember here is that the conditions of certification are part of the health IT would be part of the health IT certification program. In the past, we focused on the technical requirements and the functional requirements that attach to health IT that is being certified by ONC. And those continue to be critical to supporting interoperability and exchange. The part that Congress has asked us to also think about are what are the conditions that sit on top of that, the developers that are being certified by our program should be held to. And those conditions are very clearly laid out by Congress, and they include things like certified developers should not information block, that they should not restrict communications, that they should report as part of the EHR reporting program when that's ready. So those are some of the things that we are including in the conditions of certification and that we'll talk way more in depth about as part of the presentation in a second. 4003 includes a definition for interoperability, which we talked about, I think, as of last year, about the overall definition of interoperability that Congress has laid out, and we take that into consideration as part of our development of the rule. Next slide. And 4004 is information blocking, and just as a reminder, we'll talk about this as well, but the goal that Congress has asked ONC to take part in is the identification of the exceptions to information blocking. So we're information and action may fit under the definition of information blocking that Congress has laid out, but there's an exception to that for a number of different reasons. We've developed 7 that we think work, but we look forward to hearing from HITECH in that regard. 4005, we've included a request for information to help us learn more about how some of the health IT that's out there now, including things like FHIR 4, could help with registries and the exchange of information from registries. And then 4006 is patient access. And that's something that is woven throughout all that we've done, not only in terms of our development of the CURES rule, but also in terms of everything we're doing at ONC, really thinking about patient access and how best to support that access through our policies. And that, I think you'll see that articulated very much so in everything from the conditions of certification, but also through information blocking as well. So next slide. All right, and we also include this slide just so you can see some of where our focus is, not only in terms of implementation of what Congress has asked us to do, but executive orders that support things like competition and innovation in the healthcare space. And what we tried to put together is a rule that supports that development. Some of the provisions around APIs, for example, that would allow a landscape to exist where new entrants can enter into the health IT environment and support the needs of patients and providers, or where existing participants, existing developers can find new and innovative ways to support the needs of patients and providers as well. And then we also include some components in our rule around deregulation and ways that we can update the certification program by taking out some components that we think are no longer necessary. So, for example, removing the 2014 edition, which is an old old edition of certified health IT technology, with the 2015 edition now up and running and continuing to be implemented across the board. Next slide. So the purpose overall, I talked a little bit about this already, but innovation and competition are critical. And we want to support an environment where competition can occur and where innovation thrives. And the API provisions are just one example of that, but also supporting things like the right of access and the ability of the patient to decide where and what technology is used to hold their information, creating an environment where new apps, can support the needs of patients to pull their information from multiple sources is just another example of how innovation and competition can come together through this role. We also focus on reducing burden and advancing interoperability. So again, thinking about the API requirements, but that's just one. We include things like the electronic health information export, which supports two use cases. One is the patient being able to pull all of their information out of a health IT system that's certified, or for a provider to be able to switch who they're working with for their health IT systems. And then, of course, our US CDI standard, which is the United States Core Data for Interoperability, which is a set of information we think is critical to be able to move for interoperability needs. And that we start with a version one here, but we plan to expand on that over time. And I noted patient access, which, again, is woven throughout all of our work here. Next slide. All right, so I'm going to turn it over to Mike Lipinski, who is our lead reg writer. He leads our regulatory affairs division, and he's going to talk a little bit about the updates to the certification criteria as well as overall updates to the health information kind of rubric in which we think of the certification program. Mike?
Thanks, Elise, and thanks for having me here this morning to talk to you about our rule. I've said this at HIMSS, it's been a labor of love getting this out to the public. We're really excited to hear comments on our rule, and I'll just reiterate what Elise said. So right now you have a version of the rule that's out. It's posted on our website. The only changes that will take place between now and when they publish are formatting changes. So I just want to be clear to folks, there will be no substantive changes between now and when the rule publishes in the Federal Registry. So our proposals and policies that you see will not be changing between now and when they publish. It's really about formatting to comply with Federal Register requirements. And so that'll go on display. And then from there, it'll be displayed at the OFR, similar to the way we have it on our website. And then it will actually publish in that three-column document that you see and are so fond of, I'm sure. And at that point, the comment period will actually start, which will be, as Elise said, 60 days. So I just wanted to reiterate the process points that are taking place right now related to commenting on the proposed rule. So I'm going to first talk to you about the 2015 edition and updates that we're proposing. And as I do this, I want to go back to the points that Elise were making. First and foremost, we are trying with this rule to the best of our abilities and consistent with congressional intent, implement the 21st Century Cures Act. And then we're trying to do it in a way that achieves that purpose that Elise talked about, which is increasing innovation and competition, reducing burden, and advancing interoperability, and obviously promoting patient access. And so as I go through this, I'll try to highlight, you know, where we've, you know, kind of taken those goals and applied it to how we're implementing the Cures Act. You know, how we do it has really been in three ways. I'm going to talk to you about how we're doing it with the certification criteria. I'm going to talk to you how we're doing it with the conditions of certification, and that's primarily focused on health IT developers and their products that they have certified through our program. And then I'm going to give it back to Elise to talk to you about information blocking, which are the broader policies to promote patient access and exchange of health information for better care, patient care. So 2015 edition, the slide you have up now, I don't know if you are familiar with this, but I'd recommend if you have an opportunity to go to this website address. You'll see this icon on it. What we've done maybe about a year or so ago, maybe it's been longer than that now, we've kind of laid out all the criteria that exist in the 2015 edition. We give a little explanation of why that functionality, I guess more to the point, what that functionality is included in the criterion and what we would expect the health IT to be able to do that was certified to that criterion. And so right here, you're just seeing how we categorize all the functionalities, what we think that they promote and support, so whether it's privacy and security or care coordination. So that's just a little plug to if you want more information about the full 2015 edition, you can take a look at that in your spare time when you're not reading the rule, right? So let's move to the next slide. So again, we tried to focus on interoperability and reduce burden. So here in one slide, and you'll see a, you know, if you're familiar with the fact sheets we've been putting out about the rule, we'll be putting out one on just similar to this slide right here. We'll also have one that goes on the deregulatory actions we're proposing, which Elise alluded to a few minutes ago. But this one right here talks about the criteria. So as you can see, it was a very light touch and a focus on interoperability. From a deregulatory perspective, we're proposing to remove certain criteria that are included in the base EHR definition, and some other criteria. A lot of this is because we believe this functionality is ubiquitous across health IT now. It's either been there since the 2011 edition, or it's functionality that has both been there in the certification program, or that we don't see a developer ever removing from health IT. And the functionality itself that we're looking at isn't really focused on interoperability or any specific unique functionality. So, like, really, for example, with Problemlist and Medlist, can you record that is really what the certification program is about related to that functionality. So we're proposing to remove that so focus can be on interoperability. So you see here we've made some updates for certain criteria, so like e-prescribing. The ones I'm going to talk to you about are like the data export one and the API one. And then we have some also that we think will help improve consent management. So we'll have data segmentation privacy, and then the consent management one you can see over there. And then we some have what we refer to as attestation criteria, so that encrypting authentications credential one and multi-factor one. It's really about, you know, can your product do that? So it's really letting the public know, does it do any of these things? Not that we're requiring that the product do those things. All right, so let's move to the next slide and dig in. Okay, so the first big thing that I want to talk to you about is USCDI, United States Core Data for Interoperability Standard. So this is a standard we're proposing. You may have heard about it previously with TEFCA, beginning of last year, that was. So this really just builds on the common clinical data set and establishes a new baseline of data that should always be available for access, exchange, and use. And what we've done with this proposal is we've added some new data classes and data elements. So provenance, we're looking there really at author, I think, timestamp, and authoring organization. Clinical notes, it's I think we're proposing up to 8 different types of notes to be available. The pediatric vital signs, those were previously optional in the common clinical data set, and we're proposing those to be required information that would always be available for exchange, access, and use. And then patient address and phone number. And then the other thing noted here is there would be a schedule for updating the USCDI, and not to get too far ahead of myself, but we'll have a task force just focused on USCDI. So let's move to the next slide. Okay, so these are one of these functionalities supporting patient access as well as the exchange of health information, hopefully innovation, competition, reducing cost. A lot we're hoping can come from some of the functionalities we're proposing. This is one of them. So this is the EHI export criterion. I'll talk a little bit later about how we tie that back into the conditions of certification for developers. But there's two main use cases that we want this functionality to support, and that is a provider who wants to change their EHR vendor or health IT vendor, and then if a patient asks for all their data. So that's getting back to the cures, all their electronic data, that is. Going back to the cures, edict to try to provide patients all their electronic health information. So how we go about this, we give flexibility to the developer in terms of how they, the export standards that they use, but they're really going to have to make available ahead of time their data dictionary. So that'll be open for interpretation, and potentially other third-party vendors will develop to help pull that data out, or the developer themselves can do that. The one point I want to make clear about developers themselves doing that, and this is where we're tying policies together and info blocking the use of this certified health IT. We propose that a fee cannot be charged when it's in use. So, and we get into some of the details of what costs can and cannot be charged, but later on during question and answer. But while there could be charges to the provider for creating the product, you know, and rolling it out and implementing it, once they want to say, okay, I want to switch, we propose that there can't be a fee associated with pulling that data out of your system. And a lot of that comes from, you know, our research and discussion with stakeholders ahead of time about some of the means that are used to deny access to EHI. So I move on to the next slide. So APIs, I am not going to spend too much time on this particular slide or the next API condition slide because my colleague Steve Posnick is going to give an in-depth presentation on API, the criterion and the condition. But key here is we're going to be replacing the API that we have now that doesn't focus on a standard. We have some options that we propose in the rule as to which FHIR version of FHIR we should adopt, whether it's version 2, whether it's 4. I think we talk a little bit about version 3 and whether we should be giving optionality or so forth. So I'll let him talk about that more or you read that in the rule. But two main use cases supported by this. So that's getting the single patient's data and then multiple patient's data. Okay, let's move to the next slide. And again, as I don't want to have to say it every time, but again, we think that's another way of getting all the information out of the system, VHI for a patient. Also, we think this is going to reduce burden in terms of provider getting access to information, improving care coordination, and then obviously this should significantly promote competition in terms of the third-party apps accessing data on behalf of patients. All right, so now I'm going to go to conditions of maintenance and certification. Again, this is focused on the certification program. The developers, actually, that bring and entities that bring products in to get certified. So previously, our focus was just on the product itself and what the product could do, and that's what we certified. But Congress, aware of, you know, some market failures related to certified health IT, and we'll talk about that, and concerns expressed by constituents, set forth in the Cures Act specific areas in which they felt that there needed to be conditions and maintenance of certification. And so this rule is hoping to implement that consistent with congressional intent. So let's start talking about that. Let's move to the next slide. All right, so there are seven conditions of certification and maintenance requirements set out in the Cures Act. This rule will implement six of them. The seventh one, as noted there on your slide in light blue, we are not in a place, it's premature to try to propose that now. As if you're familiar with, we went through a process to take comments on the EHR reporting program, and we're, you know, going through the steps to establish that program now consistent with the statute and how that should be developed. So let's start talking about quickly about each of these six that we're proposing. So next slide, please. All right, this one is a pretty straightforward condition. So not only are health IT developers subject to the information blocking provision, and these are health IT developers of certified health IT, to be clear, they have a specific condition required that they will that says that they will not information block. It's as simple as that. They will have to attest to this, and then they would be held to that attestation. HHS Office Inspector General has authority over any false attestations made. So let's just move to the next slide. So the next slide is even a further backstop to information blocking, where the Secretary said where Congress said that we want, and this is again, you know, reactive to potential, at least their understanding of what potentially were market failures, that developers have to need to provide further assurances to the Secretary that that developers will not take any actions that would inhibit the appropriate access exchange use of EHI. And so if you haven't seen part of the theme here, it's now looking at the business behavior. So we're not just looking at the health IT anymore. We're looking at the actions of the developer. So I'm going to draw that out. So we've put forth four proposals, really three. One is a request for comment on how we think developers can provide assurances that they are not inhibiting. So one is an attestation that they will full compliance when they implement, full compliance with the certification criteria and requirements, program requirements when they implement the health IT. So testing doesn't necessarily always test every single functionality, every code of a relevant code set like SNOMED, but what they're going to do, what we're going to ask developers is to test that when that their product can fully conform. If you're familiar with any of the litigation that's been out there by the Justice Department or so forth, issues have arisen where developers haven't fully implemented the functionality in the field. So we're asking for an attestation related to that. And here's a tie back in with that next proposal related to that EHI criterion. So any developer that manages electronic health information, stores or manages electronic health, let's say, or manages EHI electronically, is going to have to get certified to that functionality. And then we're also going to require that they roll that functionality out to all their customers within 24 months of the final rule. So that's a way to ensure that that functionality is getting out into the field, being available to providers and patients. And then a records retention, proposal. So this is really just to ensure that the records support the functionalities that products being certified. So this is again giving assurances to purchasers and users of certified health IT that you can rely on that certification and that the product does what it says it does, and there are records to support that. And then last, we're asking, related to the Trusted Exchange Framework and Common Agreement, is whether if developers, one, support interoperability, so this is a criteria, the developers that get their product certified to functionalities that support interoperability, that's that bullet point two, and whether if they're in a situation where they essentially support participation in a Trusted Exchange, that if they should have to then sign on to the Trusted Exchange in Common Agreement. It's just a request for information at this point. There's no proposal because of the current status of the Trusted Exchange Framework in Common Agreement, but we wanted to get users' thoughts now about how it relates to developers supporting them, users and providers, and whether it would make sense that from a certification perspective, we required that type of participation on certain developers. So moving to the next slide. So this one is we call it our communication slide, and really what it is implementing a congressional provision, statutory provision, where Congress said the developers should not prohibit or restrict communications regarding the subjects you see on the screen there. And this is really about, you know, promoting safety, security of products. I think this is very important in that respect, and usability of these products. And Congress held multiple hearings. HELP had hearings on this. You have on the record developers and other parties essentially saying that there shouldn't be any gag clauses in contracts related to certified health IT. And I think we took that legislative history, congressional intent, and put forth proposals that are consistent with it. This is a very broad prohibition Congress put forward, so we've actually identified some specific instances where developers would be able to do some restrictions. So those would involve when it's their own contractors or employees, when it would be related to something like not user-facing aspects of a product, in some sense related to IP, but I want to call out here, I'm sure you've probably caught it in some of the press after the release of the rule, that we are saying that screenshots can be shared We think that the use of screenshots is fair use under intellectual property law. We do give developers the ability to have minimal restrictions there related to third-party IP in the screenshots, as long as they meet certain conditions, the altering of a screenshot, and then obviously if there's any type of PHI in the screenshot, that they would be able to place some restrictions on that. We ask the contractors via proposal remove any contractual provision that contravenes this prohibition. So within 2 years of the effective date of our final rule, we would expect that there would be no longer any contractual provisions that limit the sharing of the information on these subjects. And in the meantime, we're asking them to continually provide notices to their customers that they don't have to comply with any provision that does contravene this proposal. Okay, can we move to the next slide? So API, so this is a condition that goes with that functionality and criterion. Really there are three key pieces here. The permitted fees piece is what is kind of going into detail to a specific type of health IT, here being APIs related and consistent with our information blocking proposals related to fees. Steve's going to talk a little more about that. The transparency, so this is similar to our proposals that already, or excuse me, not proposals, our provisions that already exist in the 2015 edition to the transparency. Goes in more detail, but transparency related to the technical requirements and also business documentation for being able to essentially connect to the API. Then he's going to talk a little bit about the pro-competitive nature as well. So I'm not going to spend any more time on this in the interest of time overall, and let's move to the next slide. And I kind of talked on that, so we'll just move to the next slide after that. I think maybe the only thing I'll mention on APIs, I'm sure Steve will mention this as well, but it's another one where we expect that to be rolled out within 24 months to all users and our customers of developers, that is, so that functionality will be they'll be up to 24 months. It's not that you wait to the last 24 months, and again, Steve will talk a little bit about that, why we took that approach. But it's another way of getting patient access and improving interoperability and reducing burden. So real-world testing, Congress called this out as well. They wanted to see developers successfully test their products in the environment in which they market it and sell that. So we've tried to take a balancing burden approach with this. So we're asking developers to provide us with a plan of how they're going to do that, and then provide us results annually. And we focused again on interoperability. So the where this is going to apply is for those developers of health IT certified two criteria that support interoperability and data exchange, and those are listed on your screen here. A really unique piece to this is our proposal related to standards version advancement process. I believe that is going to be on the next slide. So why don't we jump to that next slide? Yeah, there it is. So as you know, regulations don't always keep up with standards and innovation. And sometimes they've actually inhibited it, because we have evidence and stakeholder feedback where developers and SDOs won't even move to a new version because it would be inconsistent with what's in regulation, and therefore no one either would use it, or it would be wasted effort, or it would be inconsistent with what is required to be used. So that's an instance where regulation is inhibiting innovation. So what we're trying to do here is allow developers and users to move to those new and better standards when they're available. And we're outlining a process in the rule in which a NASA coordinator would approve a newer version of a standard. So I want to be clear about this. It's a standard that's already been adopted for use case, but then a new version comes along. And we know those come along fast, 1.1, 1.2. And then, you know, users and developers are put in awkward situations, not not just the situation I talked about, but where a entity requires use of version 1.2, but you've been certified to 1.0, so now you have to go out and get a product that does 1.2 as well, because certain programs require certified health IT, but you know, certain public health agencies want you to report with version 1.2. So what we're going to do is set up a process where we can approve version 1.2 for the program. A developer can voluntarily move once they meet certain conditions, including notice to their customers, notice to their certification body, to that new version. They would have to show, though, that they can real-world test to that new version. And that is going to provide assurances to those who are purchasing and using those products that my product can do that new version too. It's not just the version that got certified originally, but they can actually do the new version. We will be, and then as a certification program for its integrity purposes, we'll be able to hold the developer to that new version as part of the real world testing condition of certification. So we're pretty excited about this. We're hoping it helps to alleviate some of our problems that we've been dealing with a lot that I've talked about. And we're really interested in comment from stakeholders on this. Let's move to the next slide. So this is just real simply, I alluded to in the very beginning, attestation. So all developers are going to have to attest to all these conditions and certification requirements. And we'll be doing this, we propose to do this every 6 months through a web-based process. We're going to be working on, we talk about this in the rule, a bit of a grace period and when in time to submit this, a lot of the process and procedure to effectuating this substantive requirement. So if you're interested in that, if you're a developer, that you may want to take a closer look at that, how we plan to execute on that. Let's move to the next slide. I think we're going to talk a little about enforcement. So this is a pretty straightforward approach here. If we can move to the next slide on this, what we're doing is we're going to leverage what we already put in place for the Enhanced Oversight and Accountability Final Rule, which was a process for direct review of certified health IT by ONC. So we're going to use that process. However, there's some unique distinctions between them that we're proposing. One is that ONC would be actually the sole party responsible for enforcing compliance with conditions of certification. I think we lay out in the rule why we think we're best situated to do that comparative to the certification bodies when it comes to the conditions such as communication condition, for example. We also propose that we would be coordinated with the Office Inspector General in case they instituted a investigation into information blocking, for example. And that we propose that in terms of, reducing burden and clarity for all parties involved, that we could either defer or to OIG or even rely upon their findings to pursue an action under the certification program. The other big thing I want to mention, and I don't know if it's on this slide, it isn't, but so maybe we can go to the next slide. Step six, so this is really just what exists current today, or step four, I should say. Ban, certification ban. So we're proposing if somehow we get, the corrective action doesn't work, and we, that is going to be our emphasis, as we said in the UA rule, to try to get products back in line and developers back in line. If it doesn't happen, we think that banning a developer is the appropriate consequence and recourse, because as I've been talking about throughout this whole discussion of the condition of certification, Congress was very specific as things that they wanted to see developers be held accountable for. And so I think, like I said, it was to address certain quote-unquote market failures they found happening. And so we think this is a more appropriate, final consequence if a developer can't come into compliance with the conditions of certification. So at this point, I think it's time to talk a little more about our overarching approach to ensuring access, exchange, and use. I'm going to be turning it back to Elise. So if we move to the next slide for information blocking. All right, Elise,
all right.
Back to you.
All right, thanks, Mike. All right, next slide. We're going to talk a little bit about our approach to information blocking and some of the policies that underpin that. So first, I just want to start off with a couple of key things to note, and I'll just reiterate what I mentioned before, which is that the secretary is tasked with identifying the reasonable and necessary activities that do not constitute information blocking. So in Section 4004 of the 21st Century Cures Act, there is a definition for information blocking as it applies to two types of actors, or two sets of actors, I should say. There's one set of actors, which are healthcare providers. And we define that in the rule. And healthcare providers have a somewhat different standard in terms of whether they are information blocking or not. And it's like, did you know standard. Now, the second set of actors are health IT developers of certified health IT. So they're ones covered by a certification program, health information exchanges, and health information networks. And there's definitions for each one of these actors in the rule. So those that second set of developers of certified health IT, information exchanges, and health information networks are subject to a different definition, which is more of a known or should have known standard. And under that rubric is where ONC now comes in to identify the exceptions for if these actors would have been subject to information blocking as per their definitions. There may be some situations where their actions were reasonable and necessary and therefore do not constitute information blocking. So that's the overall kind of rubric of how the policy is laid out and what Congress asked us to do. So a couple of other overarching notes before we get into the exceptions. The exceptions that we've developed are based upon a lot of what we heard. Now, for many of those who have been around for a while, we have definitely been thinking about information blocking. In fact, Congress asked us some years ago, I think 2015 now, asked us to develop an information blocking report on what we were seeing. And we did that, and we put that together. And subsequent to that, Congress started thinking more about information blocking and what it should look like in terms of statutory provisions. So as we are thinking about what are the things that are reasonable, we first have to know what is not okay. And that's where we really hinge on the definition that Congress has laid out. The exceptions that we put into place are really thinking about some of the situations we've heard of. Some things such as, let's say if you think about healthcare providers, a hospital system that creates different allowances for the exchange of information, depending upon whether you are a provider that has privileges at their hospital or not. Or a developer that charges extreme interface fees and changes those interface fees depending upon whether you are a provider who has their technology, or in other words, has their health IT system or not. So those are some of the things that we heard a lot about, and not once or twice. As Don has noted, you know, he has had many stakeholder meetings with stakeholders who have shared with him concerns about how information blocking practices are used to impede the flow of information that thereupon impacts the ability of the patient to get the care that they need and the ability of the provider to provide the care that they need to provide. So that's the overall concept of what we were thinking about in putting this together. Next slide. So when we think about information blocking, I highlighted this already in terms of we think about the definitions laid out by Congress, and then we think about what are the reasonable and necessary activities that would interfere, and specifically looking at the word likely, that are likely to interfere with or prevent or materially discourage access, exchange, and use of electronic health information. Next slide. So another overarching concept is the definition of electronic health information. And this definition we've put together and builds upon a definition from HIPAA in terms of protected health information. And we note a couple of key components to that definition. One, is the information transmitted by or maintained in electronic media? Does it identify an individual? Or is there a reasonable basis that the information could identify an individual? And that's important because, as we know in the rule, the information blocking provisions are not meant to address de-identified information, and that's consistent with 45 CFR 164. And also, we note that the definition includes past, present, and future health and condition of an individual. So not just current. So not just, you know, if you're a patient and you go to a provider, not just that set of information that you would receive with that particular provider. But if there's past information that's available, that would be included, as well as future. And then it also includes past, present, and future payment for the provision of healthcare to an individual. And next slide, because I want to talk a little bit about that. We include a request for information in the rule around price information. In particular, there's been a concern that many of us are aware of about how pricing information can have negative impacts on patients, providers, health systems, plans, and across the care continuum overall. The department is particularly interested in this area as well. And ONC, in terms of the definition of electronic health information, thinking about what are the types of information that should be considered price information? How is that defined? What are the electronic means for moving that type of information that may exist already or that would need to exist? And then overall, the department is seeking comment on some of the technical, the operational, the legal, environmental, cultural, and other challenges that might exist around creating a more transparent environment for price information within healthcare. So there's a request for information in the rule that includes a number of questions related to that. Next slide. So we're thinking about the definition of electronic health information and what we are trying to achieve in terms of identifying reasonable and necessary activities. One thing to keep in mind is the goal is for these exceptions to be narrow. The goal and the presumption is that information is being shared appropriately and to the benefit of the patient and the provider who's providing care to the patient. And that's an important construct because if that is kept in mind, then what we are then hoping to receive recommendations and feedback on is do these exceptions strike the right balance in achieving that? Our goal is to make sure that information is moving, and if it's not moving, that there's a really good reason why it's not moving. So with that, let's walk through each of the exceptions. So the first one is preventing harm. And this talks about was an action taken by an actor, and remember that the actors are the health care providers, health information exchanges, health information networks, and certified developers, whether there was an action taken by the actor to not share information because there was a reasonable, and that's key, a reasonable belief that the practice would directly and substantially reduce the likelihood of physical harm occurring. And if that's the case, then that actor could be subject to an information blocking exception. The next one is around privacy. And the privacy, again, keep in mind, the goal is that information is being shared and to the benefit of the patient and the provider. And if it's not being shared, then there's a clear reason why it's not being shared. And let me just stop here and note a couple of other things I should have also noted in the exceptions. In order for your action that you've taken to not share information to be subject to not be considered information blocking, then you would have to meet one of the exceptions, right? You can meet more than one, but you'd have to meet one for that particular action. And each of the exceptions are not just a high-level look at what you've done, what an actor has done, rather. It's an in-depth look at whether the overarching exception has been met, and that is accomplished by looking at the subcomponents or the sub-exceptions that exist within that. And the privacy one, 171.202, is a good example of that because there are four discrete sub-exceptions that exist, and they address specific scenarios that Dr. Rucker and ONC generally are concerned are occurring. So in order for you to get an exception for privacy-related issues, you'd have to meet one of these four exceptions. And they're delineated here, so I won't read each one, but you could see that they are related to denial of access practices, for example, that are permitted under HIPAA, specifically permitted under HIPAA. There could be some related to preconditions that exist under state laws. Or the protection of information that may exist under such state laws. We want to be inclusive of the state laws that may exist related to privacy or other federal laws that may exist to, related to specific types of information. And with that in mind, think about those subsections when an individual is thinking about whether they can apply or be subject to one of the privacy exceptions noted here. The other thing to note here is the policies should be in place. So, you know, one of the things we've heard is, you know, for example, information is not shared to one provider, but is shared to another. And the underlying policies that are in place at that hospital system or with that developer or with that health information exchange or with that network, that information, that those policies don't capture the reasons why information would or would not be shared, for example, as applicable to state law. And what's happened, what seems to be happening in some situations is that the policies change depending upon who is asking. So if you are asking for information and you are somehow affiliated with that provider, you're in the same practice or hospital, the answer you may get in terms of the request to share information may be different from, let's say, a small provider located halfway across the country in an unaffiliated practice, and they're asking for the same information, but they can't get it. Why is that the case? So those types of scenarios are what we're thinking about here. So if there is a policy that is in place and is documented, those are things that we would look at, or really OIG, Office of Inspector General, who would implement this, would look at. What are the policies that are already in place? Or are you attempting to put in policies once a situation has already happened? Those are the case-by-case and the factual analysis that would come with any information blocking examination. Next slide. All right, so talking on the same vein as privacy, you have security. And similarly here, we want to look at what are the policies that are already in place within the particular actor's enterprise or practice related to promoting the security of information. And the practice that the actor takes part in that would otherwise be subject to information blocking really has to be in place to safeguard the confidentiality, the integrity, and the availability of that electronic health information. And the practice also has to be tailored. And this goes back to the overall concept that information should be shared appropriately. And if the information is not being shared, then there really needs to be a specific reason why that's not happening. And then in this case, it has to be tailored to the specific security risk that exists. And it has to be implemented in a consistent and non-discriminatory manner. And you're going to see throughout the exceptions that we've laid out, language like consistent and non-discriminatory, objective and verifiable, words and concepts like these that support an environment that you are sharing regardless of whether you have a vested interest in that individual you're sharing with. So whether the provider is under your hospital system or not, whether if you're a developer, whether the requester has purchased your technology or not. And those are just some examples. There are many out there. And it's a very much a case-by-case analysis. But we would be looking at whether the policies you have in place or the practice you are taking to restrict the flow of information, right, whether that is objective and verifiable, whether it is non-discriminatory, whether it is consistent across the enterprise that you manage or that you have control over. And that is shown here in the security exception by that language of consistent and non-discriminatory. And then also in that last sub-bullet, the practice must implement an organizational security policy that meets certain requirements or must be based on an individualized determination regarding the risk and response in the case. So we do want to allow for situations where there is a particular security risk that may be individualized but may not be captured in the security policy. How is that identified, and is that really based on a proffer or a reason that's being given not to share information, or is it a legitimate reason? And those are part of the case-by-case examinations. The next couple of exceptions relate to costs or fees, or in some case rent, depending upon how they're referred to in the industry. But for purposes of the exceptions as we've laid them out, let's talk about the responding to recovering costs reasonably incurred first. And this relates to the allowance for an actor, remember that would be the provider, the health information network, the health information exchange, or the certified developer. But the actor can recover costs that it reasonably incurred in providing access, exchange, and use of EHI. Things that would be looked at in determining whether that cost is reasonable is, again, you see that objective and verifiable language. Are the fees charged on the basis of objective and verifiable criteria that are uniformly applied to all similarly situated persons and requests? And again, that gets to that fairness concept. Are you treating people or requesters the same who are similarly situated? Also, the costs have to be related to the cost of providing that access, exchange, and use of information. And they need to be reasonably allocated across all customers. So we have heard of examples where, you know, the development of an interface can cost money. And we want to make sure and our understanding of the fact that there are costs associated with developing technology, innovating on technology, or updating technology. In some cases, we have heard, though, of situations where the cost of that interface, even though it is the same interface that's being used by different, would be used by different individuals seeking information from that actor, that the cost is borne by one particular or a group of requesters who may not necessarily be affiliated with that actor. And those who are affiliated with the actor, perhaps they are not charged the same interface costs, et cetera. So those are things that would be looked at. Are the costs reasonably allocated across all customers? The fees also have to be cannot be based on anti-competitive or other impermissible criteria. So again, back to that fairness factor, back to supporting the competitive and the innovation that should and can exist in an environment supportive of electronic health information moving to where it needs to go. And then certain costs would be specifically excluded. And the one I really want to note here is that where an individual or their representative is requesting their information electronically through electronic means, that there could be no cost associated with that. And I think, you know, many of you have heard Dr. Rucker talk about the importance of this, that where the patient is requesting their information that electronically and that the information they're requesting is electronic health information, that there should be no cost associated with that. So it's a really important component of what we've included in these exceptions. Next slide. All right. So the next one is related to responding to requests that are infeasible. So what do we mean by that? I personally want to make sure that we're clear again that the goal of the exceptions, all of them, are that you're sharing information appropriately and that you're sharing information for the benefit of the patient and the provider. But there may be some situations where a cost is infeasible. And what does that look like, and how do folks understand whether they would fall into that or not? So we've included some clear guidelines for that purpose. So one is, just looking at the second bullet, for example, complying with the request must impose a substantial burden on the actor, and that burden has to be unreasonable under the circumstances. So perhaps it's a small provider who is being asked to develop outbound interfaces to support the receipt of information that maybe they normally would not need if not for the request from the requester. In situations like that, maybe that would be considered an infeasible request. But what's equally important in terms of looking at this and contemplating it is the third bullet, which basically says that an actor must timely respond to those infeasible requests and work with the requester to provide a reasonable alternative. So it's not just about whether the request was infeasible, but did you attempt to find an alternative means to provide access to the EHI. And that is an important consideration as to whether you would be allowed to use this exception to validate why information blocking, you should not be held to an information blocking claim. So for 171-206, this one is about RAND terms and licensing of interoperability elements. And this, again, relates to the importance of innovation that we know needs to continue to exist in the health IT environment. So there could be situations where there is a technology that is controlled by the actor that relates to interoperability elements for the movement of the electronic health information that should not be considered information blocking. And some of the factors that we would look at in terms of that licensing would be about whether you are licensing on reasonable and non-discriminatory terms. So is how you license or the cost associated to the license dependent upon whether the requester is affiliated with you or not? That would be a factor that would be looked at. And again, are the ability to license available to those across the health IT spectrum who are requesting the information? And you see that language once again here in that last bullet, that the terms of the license have to be objective and verifiable, and uniformly applied. So not just simply saying that I license these terms on a RAND basis, reasonable and non-discriminatory terms, but really, do the policies you have in place, are there supporting materials that indicate that your licensing plans or procedures are objective and that can be verified as well, and that you've applied your licensing terms uniformly across kind of requesters. So those are kind of the overall concepts that we are thinking about. And there's one more exception I want to note. Next slide, please. So this exception is about maintaining health IT performance. So similar to, let's say, the security exception, for example, there could be situations where you're not sharing information because something needs to be adjusted in terms of health IT performance. And that could apply to a number of different exceptions. In this one, it's about perhaps, let's say, you take down your health IT temporarily to address a problem or a flaw that you've discovered. And during the time that the technology is down, you receive a request for information from a requester, and you can't provide that information at the time because the system is down. Would you be subject to information blocking? Well, this exception could help to address that. But there would be certain things that would have to be met in order for this exception to be claimed, such as did you take down the system for no longer than necessary to achieve the maintenance required? Is the practice for how you take down the health information technology temporarily, is it implemented in a consistent and non-discriminatory manner, again, using those similar fairness-type terms? And in circumstances when the health IT is supplied, is there an agreement or is there some engagement with the customer regarding the unavailability of the health IT? So those are overall the seven exceptions that we've laid out. Again, I think there's going to be a lot of time for discussion for these as part of the task forces, which Mike will talk about a little bit later. And we will also have staff on hand who have worked on the development of these to engage with the task forces to discuss these further. Let's go to the next slide. Okay. So a couple of other things to think about in terms of how information blocking works procedurally. And a lot of this would sit with the Office of the Inspector General, so I won't speak on their behalf, but I want to talk a little bit about the complaint process. So the complaint process is something that we are continuing to implement and evolve. You can check on our healthit.gov website for how health IT feedback can be received, and there's an ability there for information blocking reports to come in that way as well. We look forward to working with OIG, who would be the main implementer. So for purposes of 4004, if an information blocking complaint comes in, OIG, Office of Inspector General at HHS, would do the analysis and determination of whether information blocking has occurred. And some of the things that they would consider is whether there is an assertion that one of the exceptions should apply to the actor in terms of information blocking being found or not found. After that, that that information blocker could be subject to a number of different enforcement mechanisms. One, if you are a certified developer, a health information network, or a health information exchange, you could be subject to up to $1 million per violation fines that would be determined by OIG. In addition, if you are a healthcare provider, while you're not subject to those fines, you could be subject to appropriate disincentives that are determined by the secretary. And that's something that the secretary and HHS as a whole are contemplating in terms of what that will look like going forward. In addition, we've also asked in the rule for additional consideration in terms of exceptions. So did we hit the right marks? And I think that's really important to us. It's really important to Dr. Rucker is did the exceptions, the seven exceptions we've laid out, hit the mark in terms of what are what is needed to address information blocking across the landscape? Did we get the right ones? Are there additional ones that we should consider? So that we also welcome comment on that as well. Next slide. So that covers information blocking, which was a lot of information, and we'll surely have more discussion on that. I want to highlight a couple of other sections in the rule before I turn it over to Steve. So on pediatric care and practice settings, next slide. Okay. So what Congress also asked us to do was to think about via 4001 of the CARES Act, to think about what are the needs that would support pediatric care and practice settings. And particularly the development of recommendations around that. So we took three steps to do that. One, we've developed 10 recommendations that are included in the rule for voluntary certification of health IT. So what are the things that we think are critical for pediatric care providers to think about in terms of health information technology? Second, we looked at the 2015 edition, not just what was finalized through the 2015 edition rule in 2015, but also the proposed criteria that Mike talked about earlier to identify which ones would be supportive of pediatric care and practice settings. So we look forward to feedback on that as well. Like, is our characterization of the 2015 edition certification criteria beneficial to pediatric care settings and can be used to address the needs that have been identified, and in particular the recommendations that we have noted as well. We also are planning to focus on non-regulatory initiatives as well. What informational resources could be useful to pediatric care settings to have on hand when they are thinking about purchasing health information technology or thinking about their support for their pediatric patients? And overall, when we thought about the recommendations that we developed, all of that was done in consideration of a lot of work that has been occurring over many years at HHS, including work around the development of the children's EHR thoughts, and that was developed with ARC and with CMS, and that's identified and laid out in the rule as well. Next slide. So here you have actually what was kind of a one-stop shop of what we did as it relates to health IT for pediatric care. So one, we did look at the children's EHR format, which I noted was developed through work with ARC and CMS. We developed the 10 recommendations, and you can see that there are very specific components here related to pediatric care settings, such as the biometric-specific norms for growth curves and supporting growth charts for children, thinking about weight-based drug dosage, and also age and weight-specific single-dose range checking. So those are just some, but you can see the 10 recommendations that are laid out there. And then we also looked further down on the slide at the current 2015 edition criteria that we think support pediatric care settings. And then over to the bottom right, you see the proposed new criteria. One, the overall United States Core Data Set for Interoperability, the USCDI, that specifically we think supports the interoperable flow of information which will benefit pediatric care settings. We also know electronic prescribing and the Firebase API, as well as data segmentation for privacy. Now, in the 2015 edition rule, we had a document level criteria around data segmentation for privacy. In this proposed rule, we have a deeper level for at which segmentation could occur. So that's one component that we think would be helpful for pediatric care as well. Next slide. So in addition to some of the areas I talked about already in terms of requests for information, some others we wanted to highlight in the rule and that would be included as part of the care continuum would be this one, which is around the opioid use disorder prevention and treatment and how health IT can benefit addressing the opioid epidemic. So we include an RFI, a request for information specifically on this, including questions around how for example, FHIR can be supportive of the movement of information in that respect. Next slide. We also include a patient matching RFI in the rule. CMS in their rule that Alex Muggy talked about a little bit earlier also include a complementary patient matching RFI there as well. In our RFI, we note the importance of interoperability, and we want to learn more about what mechanisms that are occurring in the field, what innovative approaches to patient matching should ONC be aware of as part of our work. We also note that GAO recently released their report on patient action, which was called for under Section 4007 of the CARES Act. Next slide. Okay, and then registries is another RFI that we've included as well, specifically noting under 4005 A and B, there's a note to interoperability and thinking about registries and how information can flow amongst registries. And that could be many types of registries, including clinician-led registries, could be public health registries across the spectrum. But we're interested in learning more about how some of things like the standard-based API that we've included in our rule, how FHIR 4, for example, might help in terms of registries and exchange with registries. Next slide. Okay, and this is a timeline. I'm not going to spend too much time on this because I think Mike highlighted a lot of these pieces as part of his discussion of the conditions of certification. But you can see generally from the effective date of the final rule, right? So when the final rule becomes effective, our expectation is that there would be a 2-year time frame by which many of these requirements would have to be in place. I would note, however, that at the effective date of the final rule is when the exceptions would be in place. But things such as the API interface with the USCDI, the electronic health information export, those of that nature, there would be a 2-year span for which implementation of those could occur. Next slide. And I think that's it. Okay. So with that, I think we're going to take a quick break if there's some questions, and then we're going to turn it over to Steve to talk about more specifically around APIs without special effort and the interplay between information blocking and the conditions of certification. So I know we'll only have time for a couple of questions, but we did want to take a break. Lauren, did you?
Thanks, Elise. Okay. So I do see one hand in the queue. Denise Webb?
Yes, thank you very much for that thorough explanation of what's included in the rule. I just wanted to note that last week while I was at HIMSS, a number of CIOs and CHIME members had shared that they were really concerned that there was only a 60-day review period for the two rules that came out. And now after listening to how extensive the ONC rule is, in particular with the number of multiple RFIs within the rule, I don't know if there can be any consideration given to extending the review period to 90 days. Like I said, a number of CIOs requested that and if that was possible so they could do a diligent and thoughtful review and to be able to respond to the number of RFIs. So that would just be a request. I don't know if that could be considered.
Yeah, we have heard similar questions at HIMSS as well. We do plan to go out with a 60-day public comment period. And keep in mind that time period has not started yet. So the rule's been out for a little bit over a week now. And the public comment period has not started yet because the rule is not published in the Federal Register as yet. So there is some additional time before that 60-day clock actually starts. We do think it's important for us to be able to move as quickly as possible towards developing the final. So we are planning to go out with a 60-day comment period. What we've done in terms of the HITECH, considering some of the policies that ONC plans to move forward with, and Mike will talk a little bit more about this later, we plan to divide the work across four task forces. which will allow for a more focus, but also, you know, a more kind of tangible ability to dig deep on some of the particular areas. And that will be the mechanism by which the draft recommendations can be developed and then moved up to the full HITECH for consideration. We'll talk a little bit about the timeline for how we're going to achieve that. And I think receiving the comments from the public through the public comment process, as well as receiving recommendations regarding the policies from the HITECH in a timely way will help us to move towards the final and to the effective date as quickly as possible.
Thank you, Elise.
Erin, another quick question?
Yeah, thank you. Elise, you walked over the definition of, you walked over the notion of providers with respect to information blocking, but there's a fairly extensive definition of the term provider that comes from the Public Health Service Act, and I think it's counterintuitive for many people who ordinarily think of providers as hospitals and physicians. So I thought it might be worthwhile just covering briefly what's included in the definition of healthcare provider.
Hey, Liz, do you want to take that one?
Yep, go ahead.
Sure. So, I mean, Erin, that's a good point. And, you know, looking back, it might have been helpful to have specified that in preamble. But we took the definition, just so you understand how we got to that. The definition of healthcare provider is cross-referenced, but it's specified in the Public Health Service Act, which is what the Cures Act amends to put all these provisions that we're implementing, makes it all part of the Public Health Service Act. And that already has a definition via cross-reference for healthcare provider. And so that term is a very broad term, as Erin alluded to, and it includes a hospital, skilled nursing facility, nursing facility, home health entity, any long-term care facility, healthcare clinic, community mental health center, renal dialysis facility, blood center, ambulatory surgical center, federally
pharmacy.
Qualified, yep, pharmacy, yep, labs, pharmacists, physicians, even those under contract with Indian Health Service, tribal organizations. If you're not familiar with Indian Health Service, they actually do provide certified health IT, or tribes purchase it themselves. Rural health clinics, some of these are also even further cross-referenced definitions of these terms that I'm mentioning to you. And then there's even any other category of healthcare facility, entity, practitioner, clinician determined appropriate by the secretary. So we definitely want and see comment on that definition, whether it's a lack of clarity or if you're, you know, whoever you may be, whether you're not clear if you're in that definition or if you think that there are certain cross-references that are unclear. So, Erin, thank you for noting that. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Okay. Not seeing any other hands in the queue, I think we're going to proceed to have Steve present on the API conditions of certification.
All right, great. How's my mic check?
Sound good.
Super. I know we've got a packed agenda, so we're going to try to get through this as quickly as possible and keep you all on pace for the rest of the discussion today. Thanks again for the opportunity. I'm going to do a deeper dive on the specific API conditions of certification in the rule and give you a little bit more context about how that intersects with the other conditions of certification and the information blocking related proposals. So you can go next slide, please. So here's a big picture, two statutory sections that my colleagues Mike and Elise just covered in detail for you. Great job, guys. There's seven conditions of certification. One of them at the bottom is not currently being proposed to be implemented. It's that EHR reporting program that we had discussions about at the HITECH previously. And then you have the seven information blocking exceptions that we propose as well. The highlighted section there about APIs without special effort is going to be the conditions of certification section that we're going to talk about in more detail. Next. Quick acronym check. So API, again, since we're going to be using that quite a bit, Application Programming Interface, FHIR, which I'm sure many of you know, the United States Core Data for Interoperability, and then another, say, new acronym that we've proposed as part of this regulatory slate of proposals called the ARCH, which is the API Resource Collection in Health, and I'm going to talk to you a little bit more about it and its importance relative to our regulatory proposals. Next. We're going to cover the big picture about the API condition of certification and how the API proposals fit together within this larger universe. So first, as already was covered, we've got the big universe of information blocking. It applies to the four actors, focused on electronic health information, actions covered by those exceptions would not be subject to penalties or disincentives. Click. We didn't work out our whole rehearsal on the animation here, so it's, it'll be quite entertaining as part of the webinar. You have the broader API conditions of certification, which fit within this universe of information blocking. And as you go through the slides with me today, you'll see a lot of similar language about reasonable and non-discriminatory terms and similar themes that were echoed already as part of information blocking. For the API conditions of certification, we have the statutory condition plus three specific subconditions that we've noted, as well as maintenance of certification requirements, which Mike and Elise covered relative to the Cures Act's requirements about conditions and maintenance of certification. Next. All right. And then lastly, within the API conditions of certification, we have the new 2015 edition Cures criterion that I'm going to talk to you in more detail. But as a high-level overview for everyone, we've got a secure standards-based API proposal with a read-only focus. H7 Fire is a base standard, and then other implementation specifications to support both provider and patient access use cases. So a number of the slides that my colleagues Mike and Elise put together and I have ahead of you are very text-heavy, and we've done that intentionally, at least for these presentations, so that they are referenceable material. We've digested a lot of the preamble and reg text into these slides. We want to make sure that everyone has a fuller context around which to take a look at the rules, read through all the various sections. They are, I think, more text-heavy than we would normally prefer to present on, but again, as a reference, we wanted to make sure that all of you had this context available. Click. Okay, so the who, what, and how of the API conditions certification. In regulatory proposals, it's important to be precise. And so for this specific conditions of certification, we wanted to make very clear who the specific actors were and how they related to each other. And so we chose specific terms. One is the API technology supplier, which is the health IT developer of certified API technology. The API data provider, which will traditionally be the healthcare organization that is the one deploying, making available the API. And then an API user, which would be persons and entities that use or create software applications. This could be, you know, third-party patient access applications. This could be a third-party service, a population analytics company that, you know, a healthcare organization partners with. It could equally be the healthcare organization themselves, and we make that clear that in some cases, a healthcare organization that's using its own API may be considered an API user in that context. With respect to how and what the API conditions, to what they apply, you have the API-focused certification criteria, which we have a slate of in our proposed regulatory text. Practically speaking, though, we're talking about regulating Fire servers. And as a Fire-based API is deployed, it's going to be done, you know, by virtue of a Fire server infrastructure. And that is what the API conditions of certification apply and the business practices surrounding them. The other important point to note is how this API conditions of certification applies. And in this respect, we want to be very clear, it applies to those health IT developers and the technology that are certified to those specific certification criteria noted above in that section. In contrast, you could, as part of our certification program, see health IT developers that get certified just for, say, e-prescribing or to do public health interface-related certification. In those contexts, if those health IT developers have products that are not certified to any of these above-referenced API-focused certification criteria, this conditions of certification or these conditions of certification would not apply at all. And so it's just an important, both from a regulatory burden and balance perspective as well as the scope of the API conditions to understand that it applies to those that have gotten certified to the API-focused certification criteria. Click. Okay. So this is going to build as I'm talking. We have a slate of required capabilities that are the functionality that are built in the certification criteria. We've attributed proposed specific standards and implementation specifications to support those required capabilities. And then we have some additional context around which there are attributed or associated API conditions of certification for certain required capabilities, as well as just some additional context I put in there for reference for those of you that want to dig into the details. But suffice it to say, there's a number of functionality that we've broken down here in terms of how a, you know, client application would interact with a Fire server, making sure that as we go through the testing processes for Fire servers, that we can appropriately focus on the right conformance test and functionality that would need to be there, conformant with the specific implementation specifications or standards. As part of our proposals thus far, and I'll get to this, I have a last slide that talks about some of these options. We did reference and attempted through our proposals to meet the industry where it was best prepared to deploy these APIs in a standards-based way using available technology. And for that, our going out proposals reference the slate of Fire Release 2 Argonaut specifications, which is that DSTU2 flavor of Fire. We did reference some of the newer updates to the Smart Application Launch Framework and the like, but we do solicit comment as part of the regulatory proposals around options for Fire versions. But that being said, the broad suite of implementation specifications, additional Fire profiles and the like that were available for a full slate of proposals for the industry to react to were available for that Fire Release 2 slate. Next slide. Just wanted to note, earlier last fall, we did release a Fire testing suite. It's called Inferno. The hyperlink's there. It's available. It's built out right now to test Fire servers for the Fire Release 2 slate, as well as many of these functionalities that we've proposed as part of this new certification criterion. And we will continue to work with industry and welcome feedback. All the code's available, open source, and very much would encourage people to go check that out. Next. The other one mentioned, we put out a blog post as well last fall about Fire implementation nationwide. This is a graphic of the percent of hospitals by the hospital referral region, where as part of 2015 edition that my colleague Mike mentioned earlier, we proposed API-oriented certification criteria, but did not attribute a particular standards requirement to it. Those of you that are from our prior Federal Advisory Committee duties, you're familiar with the kind of method behind that, but suffice to say, a majority of the largest market share or attestation share health IT developers that went through the certification program processes used Fire as part of their API certification requirements. And as we've been able to attribute that through our research, we found that almost 87% of hospitals and 69% of MIPS eligible clinicians are served by health IT developers or products certified to any Fire version. Presumably, right about now, many of them are on release 2. It aligns with what, say, Apple is requiring for their health records app connectivity and other industry app developers as well. So as we look to the future evolution, there's Fire Release 3, there's now Fire Release 4, and so we have options in the rule build out to support industry comment and feedback. Next slide. So when it comes to the U.S. core data for interoperability, here's a kind of full unpacked version. The thing that I didn't reference here in specific is that for each of these data classes and their specific constituent data elements, there are also semantic bindings to them in particular. So just like what we had with the common clinical data set and its evolution into the U.S. core data for interoperability, we have referenced the specific vocabularies or code systems that are attributable to the particular data classes and elements that we've referenced therein. And so as Mike covered, we've already proposed to include a few updates to this as we move forward, and we have a process called the Standards Version Advancement Process that we hope to use to continue to raise the ceiling above the baseline for certification over time and expand the U.S. core data for interoperability overall. Next. So the one important point to remember about the USCDI is that in order to translate the USCDI, which again is just data elements, it needs to be referenced in a way and translated into a language of Fire, right? And that's in Fire resources. So we have a lot of experience now for the better part of 10 years worth of regulating standards in understanding what we need from regulatory flexibility and administrative flexibility in order to better work with industry, keeping in mind the context of our standards version advancement proposal. So as we look to expand the USCDI and issue versions of that over time, we need a way to translate the standards agnostic from a content perspective USCDI into a fire-based way. Similarly, as part of some of our other proposals, the USCDI is translated into the CCDA as it's referenced in some existing certification criteria. So again, just to make sure that the broader audience that's listening has that context behind, there's the USCDI, which is effectively a set of data with some semantic requirements or representation, and then that then needs to get translated into the appropriate content standard or standards in which it would be used most appropriately. So for the API conditions of certification and the API certification criterion, that's a translation into FHIR, and identified the applicable FHIR resources that were necessary to support the proposed USCDI data classes and elements. And so that's what we, the way that we do that translation is by referencing what we call the API resource collection in health, otherwise known as the ARCH. You can go to the next slide. So this one's going to build. What is the API resource collection in health? It's the 15 specific FHIR resources that we selected to align to support to the USCDI. It starts with the patient at the center, so the patient FHIR resource, and then all of the rest of the FHIR resources that we reference going to build around that, and clearly there's a visual there for you to help remember the acronym, but this is the way that we reference the FHIR resources and then use the existing specifications like the Argonaut implementation guide that we referenced to add that additional profile clarity to those resources. But again, we needed a way to translate from USCDI into FHIR and then leverage existing industry implementation guides to give additional clarity and implementation certainty around those FHIR resources that we named. Equally as important as we expand the USCDI over time, again, from this translation perspective, there may be data classes that we reference in the USCDI that don't have a particular FHIR resource or profile that's specified in an existing implementation guide. So provenance is a good example. There isn't an industry implementation guide or profile that has yet been developed and published that references provenance in a way that we could attribute it as part of the proposals. And so where we give the provenance FHIR resource life is through the ARCH. We also provide areas where we need to supersede additional or existing industry implementation guidance to make sure that USCDI data policy is referenced appropriately from a conformance perspective in the existing FHIR resources or the conformance requirements for FHIR. So another example there would be patient address. If I'm not mistaken, in the existing implementation guidance that's available, it's not referenced as mandatory. So we use the ARCH as a way to indicate that not only is this required as part of the patient FHIR resource, but it also needs to be a mandatory element of that profile or resource as it gets implemented. Next slide, please. So this slide is going to build again. This is a takeaway slide, high-level overview of the full API conditions of certification and maintenance of certification requirements. The first section here on the slide is the statutory requirement with the noted reference to without special effort. We have the three specific, let's call them subconditions within the conditions of maintenance of certification for the API condition of certification, as well as the at the bottom here, the maintenance of certification requirements. I'm going to touch on these very briefly, just because this is the only place where they're referenced in detail. So we have registration requirements around how apps engage with health IT developers and register their apps. So there's a maintenance certification requirement. Again, as we look at the maintenance certification conditions overall, as you look at some of the other conditions of certification, this is an ongoing responsibility that health IT developers have in order to maintain their certificates that are issued to their products. And so this is a, you know, once you get certified, there's a certain amount of requirements you need to meet in order to get certified. And then as we look forward into the future implementing the Cures Act, there are maintenance and certification requirements as well. So the second one here is important as we understand for industry. When we talk about deploying FHIR-based APIs, they have an associated endpoint to which the apps can and other services can connect. And so it's important that those endpoints are made available so that various stakeholders can point their apps or services toward what are called specifically service-based URLs, but effectively Firebase API endpoints. And we have maintenance certification requirements around this because it's an ongoing expectation as more and more customers, get their API endpoints stood up, that those would be made available and publicly accessible in some manner. Lastly is the compliance timeline and implementation for rolling out the new API standards-based certification criterion, as Mike mentioned, it would be 24 months from a final rules effective date. We had a choice here about creating an arbitrary certification deadline for health IT developers, but again, given experience that we have now implementing the program and numerous rules, we decided to set an overall outcome for industry and then let health IT developers, based on different technical architectures that they may have, cloud versus on-premises installations, to determine the best cadence and certification timelines that they would need to work out with their customers overall. And we proposed the 24-month timeline post a final rule, given the proposals and all the expectations that developers would now have. Next. So this first of the subconditions within the API condition certification applies to transparency. I'm going to touch on these really briefly. As many of you know, and is a good practice as part of many other industries beyond healthcare, when it comes to having APIs, it's important to have the technical documentation available as well as other business documentation so that we operate in a open and competitive marketplace as well as one that allows for proper technical connectivity. And so we have requirements around the API technology supplier, which in this case is, again, the health IT developer, publishing all of its terms and conditions in a specific numerated list underneath that. We have a requirement about the fees, which I'm going to go into a little bit more detail. As they are permitted, API technology suppliers need to describe those fees in detailed and plain language, and that gets down to the, if there are variable ways in which fees are calculated, having access as, say, an API user or an app developer to be able to calculate what you think those expected fees may be relative to the particular customers that you're going to be engaging with. And then we also have a proposal around a permitted process. If an API technology developer wants to go through a process to verify the authenticity of an app developer, they would be permitted to do so. They're not required to. But if they do implement such a process to verify the authenticity, the good standing of an app developer, they would be able to do so so long as they're completed within 5 business days of receipt of that app developer's request to register their software application with the API technology supplier. You can go to the next slide. All right. So we're going to dive in to the deepest part of the presentation here in terms of the API conditions of certification and its intersection with information blocking. And this is really a close intersection with permitted fees. The API technology supplier, which was the circle that was highlighted down below in that left corner, they are the actor that is regulated by the API conditions of certification when it comes to who we have direct authority over from that portion of the Cures Act. With respect to information blocking, as you all well now know from the earlier presentation, that's a more complicated and over a bigger umbrella of actors that are involved relative to the relationships that are here. So I wanted to depict, we have API technology suppliers that have two different types of relationships, one with their customers, API data providers, and that has both information blocking and API conditions of certification related overlays. And then similarly for API technology suppliers, they may have direct relationships with API users in certain contexts, and that equally has API conditions of certification relationships as well as information blocking overlays. And then lastly, when it comes to API data providers, which would be healthcare organizations in this context, they will have a relationship with API users or others. This could be patients, patient access, applications, third-party services, et cetera. And they will also, because they're covered by the information blocking related statute provisions, have some type of relationship between their work between API data providers and API users. Click. When it comes to the permitted fees, we've proposed three categories of permitted fees that could exist underneath the API conditions of certification, and that would be a deeper and more specific set of proposals that go beyond the broader information blocking related exception. And so when it comes to the relationship between the API technology supplier and the API data provider, we have two permitted fees, one around the development, deployment, and upgrades that would incur fees and costs associated with the API technology supplier, as well as API usage costs that would be incurred by the API technology supplier in instances where they are hosting or providing the API services on an ongoing basis for their customers, the API data providers. The third permitted fee is around what we call value-added services that API technology suppliers could offer to the broader market, and I'm going to cover that in more detail on some subsequent slides. You can go to the next slide, please. So there's going to be scenarios, two scenarios, you can click again, that we're going to cover in more detail now about how these relationships apply and the specific proposals underneath. Next. So when it comes to the overall conditions that apply from a permitted fee perspective, we had a choice about whether or not to start to list out an exhaustive list of fees that would be allowable, and understanding that that would create a what I would like to call a perpetual guidance mode for ONC, we decided from a clarity perspective that we would start with a clean slate and say, if we were operating in a world where, you know, no one could make any money and there wouldn't be any opportunity for research and development, then we would prohibit all fees altogether. And that would, you know, create a no-fee world for APIs, recognizing that there will need to be reasonable returns on investment, opportunities for research and development and innovation. We started with that baseline of there are no fees that are permit are all fees are prohibited unless they're otherwise permitted. And so then we kind of work our way upward. And so the opportunity for industry as they have an opportunity to comment on our proposals is to identify either where we have not sufficiently made clear or if there are areas where there's ambiguity about certain types of fees that they believe they should be able to charge vis-a-vis their APIs. Or how they supply them, and that we could potentially build into final rule versions of this, or if there's a permitted fee for API deployment or usage, et cetera, that we hadn't adequately considered and that we should make sure that we clarify as part of the final rule. So the onus is on industry to identify where there are more fees that they believe they should be permitted to be able to charge. So for the broadest aspect in terms of how the general conditions apply to fees. Again, piggybacking on the information blocking universe that you understand based on the presentation earlier, there's a lot of repetitive language that we've emphasized here again about the fees being objective and verifiable, that they need to be reasonably allocated among all customers, that they need to be reasonably related to the cost of supplying the API technology, and that they can't have a competitive basis upon which the fees are being charged. And so, I'm not going to cover each of these, verbatim, but that's the gist of how, if for any of the subsequent permitted fees, they all need to apply or conform to these specific provisions. Next slide. So when it comes to permitted fee number one, which is development, deployment, and upgrade fees, you can click one more time. Should have built. All right. The first bullet here is the actual permitted fee. So an API technology supplier is permitted to charge fees to recover costs reasonably incurred when they develop. So the actual work to do the engineering, recognize that, investment needs to be made, costs are incurred to develop, deploy, and then upgrade the API technology for the API data provider. The one thing that we wanted to make very clear, since we in this type of situation, you have the API technology supplier that is, say, upgrading the API technology of an API data provider that then may work with a third party that they choose for various different services or patient access application, that the API technology supplier can't take into account the API users that their customers may interact with and subsequently step in front of the API data provider to try to recoup additional fees that would be, for the, let's say, the privilege of working with their customer, the API user now needs to pay the API technology supplier. So we made very clear as part of the proposals that this type of relationship fee, as I've got there in quotes, would fall into something that would be a prohibited fee, and the API technology supplier would not be able to charge API users directly on the basis of the fact that they're just, you know, the API data provider wanted to work with that API user. Next slide. The next permitted fee is around API usage costs, and so there's a bunch of detail here that I cover. Again, the first bullet here is the actual proposal. So we recognize that, you know, once you get your API technology in place, there, as an API data provider, there will be ongoing maintenance, usage costs, et cetera, in terms of being able to maintain that API at increased, volumes and scale, and that there would be charges associated with it if you need to, get a better server, something that can handle more scale or volume, better performance, et cetera, that those would be costs, especially in a case where an API technology supplier is, let's say, hosting or administering that API technology on behalf of an API data provider. We wanted to make sure that the API technology supplier could recoup those costs for providing those hosting and administration services. The one thing that I wanted to make clear here as well, again, because there's this, kind of three-way relationship that we're keeping in mind, the API data provider is the one that will be making their API technology available to third parties with whom they choose. It could be for their own particular uses. It could be for, providing patients access to their health data via an API. But in all cases, the financial relationship needs to be defined between the API technology supplier and the API data provider. And so if the API data provider were to sign up for a particular, tier of API service per month, and they exceeded that, then we wanted to make clear that the API data provider would be they would need to reconcile whatever those additional costs incurred above their, original contract. Let's call them overages, for lack of a better colloquial term. They'd need to square that up with the API data provider. So in instances where an API user that an API data provider may partner with, say for their own internal uses, if they use more bandwidth, for lack of a better example here, than they otherwise originally paid the API technology supplier to provide them, then the API data provider, again, is on the hook for reconciling those charge increases. The only other one thing I wanted to note at the bottom, just as I'm sure you're reading through, we did, even though we proposed to allow a particular type of permitted fee for API usage costs, we did not propose or restrict the methodology that an API technology supplier would take in order to engage with services for that API data provider. And so there's no particular fee amount. There's no threshold, there's no methodology. All that is up to the API technology supplier to determine. We've certainly seen in other industries, you can pick, mobile, cell phone carrier, telecom industry, where, those of us remember the days when we got charged, for text message, and then that was unlimited, and then we got charged for video and, pictures, and now that's, built in. So there's various different methodologies that we expect to evolve over time, and we didn't see the need necessarily to propose, specific methods that would be the only methods that would be permitted. That being said, API technology suppliers, in determining their methods, again, would need to make sure that if there are calculatable ways, that needs to be part of their documentation that's made transparently available, that their methodology complies with the general conditions for permitted fees, and that it doesn't violate something that would be part of the broader information blocking related provisions overall. Next slide. All right, we got one more set. Keep going. There are some accounting-related aspects to the permitted fees as well, but the one that I wanted to emphasize that we carried through, as that Elise mentioned briefly, when it comes to patient access, we took a very specific line and said any costs incurred that facilitate a patient's ability to access, exchange, and use their health information cannot be a permitted fee that would be allowed to be charged as part of the API usage cost. The subsequent bullets that are referenced below are again, those accounting-oriented provisions. And then the last bullet there, I just wanted to reiterate, as part of both of these permitted fees have that same relationship orientation in terms of prohibiting relationships from being relationship fees from being established and kind of going around the API data provider for the API technology supplier to charge API users based on, you know, the relationship that they develop with the API data provider. And the reason why that point is important is going to be a part of the openness and pro-competitive conditions of certification that I'm going to discuss in a little bit. Next slide. This is the last permitted fee. You can click one more time to build. There we go. So an API technology supplier is permitted to charge fees for value-added services that would not be supplied in connection to get something that would be necessary for the efficient and effective deployment and development of such software, right? So if there are above and beyond services that an API technology supplier wants to provide in order to make themselves more attractive for app developers, to provide other market differentiating software, you know, they have the best customer service or, you know, level 7 technical support, other things that would, as the examples here in the third bullet, make it more attractive for different app developers, co-branded integration, co-marketing arrangements. As I mentioned before, our focus right now is on read-only apps. So if a API technology supplier wanted to offer very detailed integration and write testing for an app developer, that could be considered part of their value-added services suite for which they could charge fees. And so that's, again, the purpose of this proposal is to identify where there would be a permitted fee that would not constitute information blocking and wouldn't violate the otherwise aspects of the overall prohibition around permitted fees. The one other thing that I wanted to note here at the bottom, we do allow for and wanted to make clear that API technology suppliers would be able to administer their own app stores, in quotes, some type of market if they want to, provided that they don't violate this condition of certification and information blocking policies. And so it's important, and this example is one below where we noted in the rule, as I basically quoted verbatim, that if an API technology supplier were to use its app store, for lack of better terms, as a gatekeeping mechanism to prevent its customers from being able to use applications that were developed for that API on the sole basis of the apps paying to get listed, then that would create a suspect relationship in terms of the value-added services and would constitute special effort and could raise information blocking concerns and potentially be a violation of this permitted fee for value-added services. And so, again, a lot of the proposals that we have around creating the boundary conditions and clarity and guardrails, as has often been referenced, around which we want a competitive marketplace to exist, transparency to exist, pro-competitive practices to exist in ways that would not constitute special effort for the various actors that are involved in the API ecosystem. Next slide. I'm going to go very quickly through my last slate of slides here on the openness and pro-competitive conditions. So this is the last sub-condition as part of the API conditions of certification. The first main overall proposal that we have is that the API technology supplier must grant an API data provider, so in this case, a healthcare provider, with the sole authority and autonomy to permit API users to interact with the API technology. And so to say that more clearly, once a healthcare organization has been upon receipt of their API technology, this proposal in this language here means it's their API technology. And they should be free to choose which third parties they interact with, other types of services that they want to use. And this gets to the kind of pro-competitive conditions in terms of, the API technology supplier, previously in certain areas where we've heard concerns that if the API technology supplier has a competing, say, clinical decision support service, that they wouldn't permit their API data provider, their customer, from using a third-party application because that would otherwise compete with the API technology supplier's offer. And so we want to make very clear that it's the API data provider, the healthcare organization, that gets to choose which services and applications they want to use to access their API technology and so on and so forth. So when it comes to the API technology supplier, They must provide the technology on terms that are no less favorable than it provides itself. And there's some more specific terminology. Again, this is going to be variations of the reasonable and non-discriminatory theme, objective and verifiable criteria. And then, as I just mentioned, the API technology supplier must not offer different terms of service on the basis of whether an API user with whom an API data provider has a relationship as a competitor. So this gets to the scenario that I just mentioned before. And also that an API technology supplier must not condition the access on revenue or other value that the API user with whom an API data provider has a relationship may derive. And so an API technology supplier in other instances or anecdotes that we've heard would prohibit a third party from working with their customer because that third party may, you know, have a valuable service that will, create revenue or value for that third party, and they happen to be a competitor of that API technology supplier. And so you have these anti-competitive practices that pit or put the API, the healthcare organization, in the center. And so we wanted to do, to again, with our proposals, make these clear lines and guardrails around which the market could compete. Next slide. That was the non-discriminatory terms. To the next slide, we have the rights and access of API technology. So again, this is similar to the information blocking provision, so I won't focus too much time on this with respect to licensing and being providing the rights that are necessary to interact and use the API technology. Specifically to the little section here on the right, an API technology supplier must not condition any of the rights described on a requirement that the recipient of those rights, so either the API data provider or an API user, pay a fee to license the rights, like a royalty or revenue sharing arrangement. These are other behaviors that we've seen in the market up until this point that was raised to Congress, raised to us as part of information blocking, and as part of what would constitute special effort in the overall context of anti-competitive and anti-competitive market behaviors. So in order to promote a more pro-competitive market landscape and ecosystem, a number of these, let's call them, subconditions are applicable in terms of the various different market behaviors that are available. Next slide. The last one here. Just get to the service and support obligations. So this takes on the, let's call it the less sexy, more mundane aspects of making sure that the API technology is continue to be maintained, that all the support and services that are reasonably necessary to enable continued, effective deployment and use of the API technology is, continue to be made available. That compatibility as the API is upgraded and changed is maintained. In order to avoid disrupting, API technology use in production settings. We know from other industries and market behaviors that as a gateway, as a doorway to data, the APIs are used to cut off access to third parties that may be competitors of theirs, which would be a no-no under these proposals, but also that let's call that, non-visible or not visible to the lay public, certain tweaks or subtle changes to APIs can make access to them, difficult for third-party services. And so as if those types of behaviors were to, crop up, we wanted to make sure that we had proposals that were, leverageable to address either from an API conditions certification violation perspective or from an information blocking perspective as well. And then we have, an exception here at the bottom. If there are exigent circumstances, we understand. However, if there are going to be changes, the API technology supplier would need to be transparent and provide notice to its API data providers as well as registered applications that, hey, a change is coming. Here's what the change will include. They're on notice then that those changes are coming and they won't be caught off guard by, say, a tweak to the API, infrastructure that may otherwise affect their product access to that data. Next slide, please. All right. Last slide. Thank you for bearing with me and going through this pretty quickly. There are a few opportunities for requests for comments, very specifically. There are now four releases of FHIR that are out there, three of which are, you know, kind of in production in various modes. And so, you know, what we've proposed is what is listed there as option one, FHIR release two. We have two intermediate options, and then the last option there is to just finalize a set of regulatory requirements that would center around FHIR release four and its accompanying implementation specifications. There's a more specific request for comment on the document reference and provenance resources, which, because they weren't referenced in existing implementation specifications, there aren't clear search parameters like there are as part of the Argonaut implementation guide around some of those other FHIR profiles. So we have comments there about what search parameters would be need to be supported or would be best to support. We have additional comments requested on permitted fees. So again, the opportunity onus is on industry to identify where there are permitted fees that should be allowable from an API technology perspective. Very specific for those of you that are out there technically, next two proposals there around reasonable upper bound for refresh tokens, which are part of the OAuth workflow, as well as dynamic client registration protocol, which is how apps register to, you know, FHIR servers to oversimplify things. We permit dynamic client registration, but recognizing the app developer authenticity verification that we propose, that there could be other means and mechanisms so long as they take place in a timely manner, that apps could be registered with the different FHIR servers. The one other thing that I would mention from a security perspective is that just like how patients or other services interact with APIs today, be it proprietary or the ones that have been you know, deployed now in 2019 as part of meeting CMS promoting interoperability program perspectives, you know, the healthcare organizations, in this case API data providers, that will be making the data for which they are the stewards of available in the patient access use case, they have obligations under the, you know, HIPAA security rule specifically, but, you know, the broader HIPAA universe, you know, to make sure that, you know, the persons to whom they are disclosing that information have been identity proof, that they have a, you know, verifiable relationship with them. And, you know, often, as it is, as our experience is today, you know, we get access to our health information via the numerous portals that our healthcare organizations have made available to us. Our expectation is, you know, during these, you know, transition years, that the authentication credentials that are issued from healthcare organizations to the individuals with whom they have a relationship will be the mechanism by which patients gain access to their health information, just like they do today when they go onto a website, you know, a portal, a web-based way. Similarly, if they do that, you know, via an application of their choice, they will equally use those same credentials and authenticate themselves to a healthcare organization. We are not prescribing that, you know, username and password be used, but that is, you know, de facto kind of the state of the art right now from a technology perspective that many healthcare organizations have deployed. That being said, we don't have any prohibitions or limits on the type of authentication methodologies that healthcare organizations may use. So that's an opportunity for innovation and expansion over time. And then equally, when it comes to a healthcare organization in this context, an API data provider working with a third party of their choice for their own business purposes and using their API, that is, you know, fully covered in the normal, you know, HIPAA paradigm where they have all of their privacy rule, all of their HIPAA security rule, and business associate related contractual relationships that they would need to establish. So these proposals that we have, you know, put out as part of this proposed rule don't change that dynamic at all from a security perspective, both technologically as well as, you know, from a legal and contractual perspective. All of that, you know, still remains in that context, you know, and would need to be protected just as it is today if they're using a proprietary API to connect to a third-party service. So I just wanted to make sure, again, you know, we know that security is often raised as a concern, you know, it's important to keep in mind the various contexts and layers of the security requirements that already apply in the healthcare setting today, the boundaries you know, between healthcare organizations' responsibility under HIPAA, the patient's right of access, where you do cross, you know, today under the laws, once that data gets into the hands of the patient, they become the steward of their own data, and that that boundary is ended from a HIPAA perspective, as well as just the technical security requirements that they would otherwise have to comply with, you know, via proprietary API or some other interface methodology. We just happen to be proposing a secure standards-based API approach that would be more generally consistent and deployed industry-wide. So with that said, I appreciate your time. I know that was a lot to digest just in this one conditions of certification. I promise you all of the other ones are as entertaining as this one. And very much look forward to your comments and appreciate all of the time that you will spend in advance digging through the rule and giving us the best recommendations you can. So back over to, I think, Mike.
Thanks, Steve. Okay, so that's a good segue about giving us your recommendations. So maybe we can pull up the next set of slides, which will talk about task force. Yeah. Let me see. Okay. So, next slide, please. All right. So we have set out four task force to help you as members of the committee provide us comments on our proposals. Some you've heard about in depth today. Some that we did not even touch on in specificity today. So those you can see on your screen are four of them. Let's try to take each one real quick. So why don't we just move to the next slide? I know we're up against it on time. So those four task force will provide you with staff support. So listed here, just you'll have this slide deck just if you need to refer back to it for names. But these will be the ONC leads on that. I may even participate on the first presentation on info blocking when we do that. And then obviously there's some subject matter experts that we'll bring in depending on what specific topic or proposal is under discussion. So we can move to the next slide. We'll go into each of these. So the first one, as you've already surmised, is information blocking. So the overarching charge is you're going to be looking at the information blocking proposals, which are almost essentially a rule in themselves, 200 and some pages just on info blocking. But you'll also be looking at it, the associated conditions. So there's that information blocking and assurances conditions I went over. And then we also thought it was important to talk about the communications one as well when talking about that. Seemed to fit there, so to speak, because it's more based on business practices and policies. And then last, we'll touch on the enforcement of the conditions and maintenance of certification. So that's all of them, the process that we have in place. The you know, there shouldn't be much time spent on that. It's, as I said, in terms of there aren't really many unique proposals there other than like the certification ban and ONC's role and how we coordinate with OIG. But otherwise, it's the same processes we have in place for ONC direct review of certified LFT. So there's some more specifics here on the slide for you. So we'll look at some of the definitions in terms that where we think you can provide us input, such as the network definition, or looking at the price information requests for information. Obviously, the seven exceptions, the complaint process, if you have any thoughts there, we need to set that up per the Cures Act. And then also, we have a request for information rule for the whole department, and same with that price information one, I should say that's for the whole department, regarding disincentives for healthcare providers that are required to be established through rulemaking by the secretary. Okay, so let's go to the next task force. The conditions of certification. So we went over those, but this particular task force will focus on more of the technical and certification, I guess, program specific ones. So when I say certification specific, I mean specific. I'm talking about ones where, you know, how will you comply with those attestation requirements, you know, that web-based portal that I was talking about, some of the submissions, which should be in the plan. We have our proposals in the preamble about and reg talks about what are the certain criteria that have to be in every real-world plan submitted by a health IT developer. So have opportunity to weigh in that. You have the opportunity under this task force to weigh in on all those specifics that Steve so eloquently laid out to you about our API criteria and condition of certification. And then you also look at some of the other criteria that I mentioned early on that we are proposing. And then some more, I don't want to say mundane, but more technical modifications to the program. There's not much there on that. It really is more focused on our certification bodies. And then those deregulatory actions I mentioned in the beginning, there are six of them that we proposed. So we can move to the next slide and talk about that third task force. So this is the Health IT for the Care Continuum Task Force. So primarily it's focused on, or would be focused on, our proposals related to supporting pediatric care and practice settings with Health IT. However, we'll also, and that includes like the recommendations that we put together, as well as the criteria that we identified. There are technical worksheets as well. They're going to be appendix to the proposed rule. And then particular criteria that support both pediatric care setting, but multiple settings, behavioral health, long-term, any setting really. And those are those ones that manage consent. So that's DS4P and consent management for APIs criteria. And then, as mentioned by Elise, the request for information regarding how Health IT can support the treatment and prevention of opioid use disorder. And that's in alignment with the strategy that the department has set forth for addressing the opioid crisis. And then last, moving to the next slide, our fourth and final task force. This will be focused just on the USCDI. So you'll be looking at, as up here on this chart, the specific data elements that are included, and then the approach to moving to next new versions of the USCDI. Okay, I think at this point we can move to the next slide and turn it back to Lauren. Okay, to talk about timeline and process.
Yeah, thanks Mike. So as Elise mentioned at the top of the call, once the proposed rule is published in the Federal Register, that will start the official clock on our 60-day comment period. Sorry, I think we skipped a slide there. We could go back to the timeline slide. Thanks. So we just wanted to kind of give you an idea of kind of how the 60-day period will look like over the course of, you know, 8 weeks or so. So we're starting today with an overview of the charge, overview of the rule and the HITECH charges. As soon as possible, hopefully as early as next week, we will start each of the task force meetings and drafting early recommendations in that second, between the second and fourth week. The fifth week is critical because we want to then present the draft recommendations from the task forces to the full committee. Of course, there'll probably be some updates and revisions and feedback to the task forces from the full committee, with wrapping up final recommendations from the full committee in that eighth week, right around the 60-day comment period. So again, just emphasizing that although it is a 60-day comment period, at the task force level, we'll need to wrap up those draft recommendations right around week five so that we can meet that timeline. So as soon as we get a date of when it will be published in the Federal Register, we'll present a more finite timeline with exact dates, but just wanted to give you an idea of what the next few weeks are going to look like. Next slide. Okay, so I know I've been bugging you guys to identify which task force you will want to participate in, so now that you have a little bit more information, please just shoot me an email today, if possible, letting me know which task force you like to serve on and whether or not you're interested in serving as chair. And then we will send around a final announcement regarding the task force, the list of members and the chairs. Just want to remind the members that you can sign up for more than one if you're interested and available. And if you've participated on a task force before, you have an idea of how much work is involved at the task force level. So if you can't participate in more than one, you're certainly welcome to listen in on all of the other task force calls. And, of course, those will all be posted on healthit.gov. So with that, I know that was a lot to take in. We've had an overview of the role, and we've now officially established our task forces, and it'll be pretty busy from here. So if you have any questions about the task force establishment, just let me know. But do know that in our first task force meetings, we'll plan to have a little bit more of a deep dive into each of the topic areas that Elise and Mike and Steve discussed earlier today. And there you have their contact information if you have any other questions on their presentations. With that, Elise or Steve or Mike, anything else before we transition to our next agenda item?
Well, I just wanted to note, you know, just advance appreciation for all the work that the HITECH has before them regarding and helping to inform our policies in these areas. We think it's really helpful. We know it is a tight time frame, but we have laid out on that staff lead slide a number of staff who are going to be able and available to the task forces and the full HITECH to help support whatever needs you may have as you are developing these recommendations. And so that's my staff as well as some of Steve's staff. And then I myself and Mike, Steve, we are all available as well. We really do appreciate the work that I think is about to begin. And we do know that there are some tight time windows for this, so we're hoping that the task force structure we've laid out will help in that as well. So my advance appreciation, and thank you for listening to what was a very long and detailed presentation, but we hope it provides a good overview of what we've included in the room.
Yeah, it's Don Rucker. I'd like to second at least Steve and Mike's thanks for this. There's obviously a number of details here. We think overall there's a certain simplicity to this, to be honest with you, but we look forward to the task force recommendations.
Okay. With that, I think we will transition to yet another very important matter before the committee, and that is our first look at our HITECH annual report. So I will turn that over to our co-chairs of that work group, Erin, Mary, and Carolyn Peterson.
Thanks, Lori.
Perfect. Thank you very much. Appreciate it. Carolyn, go ahead if you want to start.
Sure. So now that we've had a really extensive dive on the interoperability work and the task forces that we will be going into for the next couple of months, it's time to take a look at where we've been over the last year and get ready to finish up our report and move that on so the national coordinator can take that to Congress. So today what we're going to do is briefly review our timeline and our process, go through the information that is in the draft report, which was sent out to you on February 8th, and then we will be looking for feedback about what's in that report and anything that we need to add to it. Our goal is to address all of those questions and concerns at our next annual report work group meeting on March 1st, and then to bring you back at the March 20 meeting a report that is complete, addressing all those points, to show you that, and then to vote on it at the 3/20 meeting. We feel that's important because by that time, the task forces will be fairly deep into their work, and it will be really important that you have as much time available as possible to work on the task force matters. So we want to get this out of the way. So with that, I will launch into our presentation. We could have the next slide, please. This is our membership and some of the ONC staff who have helped us, and I want to reiterate that they have really been extraordinarily helpful in drafting text for us, in listening to our discussions, and finding references that support these points so we can provide a good work product. I know my thanks goes also to my co-chair, Erin, and to Christina, Brett, and Chesley, who have also been involved in some really great feedback. Next
and
slide.
I echo that. I absolutely echo the same thing, Carolyn.
Thanks, Erin. So our work group scope, overarching scope, is that we are informing, contributing to, and reviewing the draft and final versions of the annual report that will be submitted to the HHS Secretary in Congress. So we are tracking our HITECH progress, and we are also providing some input as to what we might do in the coming years. Next slide, please. Taking a more detailed look at the scope, this has to do with the 21st Century Cures Act, and we are providing an analysis of HITECH progress with regard to the target priority areas. We have an assessment of the health IT infrastructure and advancements in the priority target areas, an analysis of existing gaps in policies and resources, and ideas for potential HITECH activities. Next slide, please. So the next steps in meeting schedules, next slide. We need to review the report and do some suggested edits today. We will look at reviewing and approving this revised report at the 3:20 meeting. Then HITECH will forward that approved final report to the national coordinator, and the national coordinator will take the report to Congress and the HHS secretary. Next slide, please. So today we're talking about the draft, and the work group will address any of our changes on March 1st. We will bring that back to you in March, and then in a few weeks we will begin working on the fiscal year 19 annual report. Next slide, please. We will again today look at changes. In March we will approve, and then that will go forward. Next slide, please. And Aaron's going to pick it up at this point and cover what we've done so far.
Yes, and thank you, Carolyn. And again, I want to echo one more time my sincere appreciation to the ONC and to the HITECH for the fabulous work here. All right, next slide, please. All right, so from a report outline perspective, it's really set up like this. We have the executive summary. There's a foreword there from our illustrious co-chairs of the HITECH, an overview, the progress we've made in FY18. We look at the health IT infrastructure landscape analysis. We then do a gap analysis on that infrastructure, then recommendations on addressing those gaps, and then suggestions for us to consider for some additional HITECH initiatives, and of course a conclusion in the reference material. Next slide. All right, so as noted in Section 4003 of the 21st Century Cures Act, we're looking at these four areas in particular. One, interoperability, two, patient access, three, privacy and security, and then four, any other target area related to the above previous three that I just mentioned that the HITECH identifies as an appropriate area that we could consider on a temporary basis with adequate notice to Congress. This last one's important because there's obviously a gambit of other dimensionality to health IT, and so it's good for you all to consider, are there other things we really want to think about and think through that we may need to debate and consider and propose additional consideration for? Next slide. All right, so what have we done in FY18? We've had seven HITECH meetings. We've really established a policy framework around that. Accomplishments of some of the subcommittees. There were 9 meetings of the Trusted Exchange Framework Task Force with 26 recommendations submitted to the ONC. The US CDI Task Force, there was 9 of those meetings with 9 recommendations submitted. The Interoperability Standards Priorities Task Force, 6 meetings and an initial list of priority uses. And of course, this annual report work group. And then we had 3 official meetings of those, and then kickoff and interactions with the HITECH, and probably a billion emails amongst all of them between each other. Next slide. All right, so priority target area. Let's look at the landscape analysis here for interoperability. Overall, the interoperability remains fragmented and uneven. HHS has proposed regulations and a trusted exchange framework. Work is underway to identify priority uses of health IT and associated standards and implementation specifications. Related to privacy and security, definitely needed to advance and maintain trust and interoperability and protect patients. Next slide. As related to patient access to information, we've noted that it can have a positive impact by supporting shared decision making, and we definitely need more information, education, accessibility, and use of application programming interfaces, APIs, as needed, which obviously the first hour or so of this meeting, ONC did a fantastic job of explaining the importance of that. Next slide. All right, so let's look at the gap. The Cures Act requires an analysis identifying existing gaps and opportunities in policies and resources for achieving the FY18 objectives and benchmarks and furthering the interoperability throughout the health IT technology infrastructure. Next slide. All right, so the Cures Act requires recommendations for high-tech activities to address the health information technology infrastructure gaps. And we're going to go into that here in a bit and just in some detail. Next slide. All right, let's talk about interoperability. We noticed a key gap here with a need to increase the level of interoperability. And the opportunity really is addressing this, what we're calling the reality gap, between the perception of what has been certified for a system and what is truly interoperable in the field. Our recommendation that we'd like for you all to think through and talk through are further measuring whether systems are truly interoperable at both content and transport levels after implementation, especially among smaller practices and by patients. Next slide. As related to privacy and security, we noticed a key gap around the implications of the emergence of Internet of Things. As an opportunity, we need to consider some appropriate policies for IoT-type devices, healthcare devices. And then our recommended high-tech activity is identify those areas of IoT use that would benefit from guidance and examples of success in the healthcare industry. And as you all see in the news every single day, there's more and more of these devices that are becoming prevalent. So how do we start getting our arms wrapped around it and consider all the dimensionality of that? Next slide. Another item around privacy and security here, we noticed a key gap with a lack of user awareness and education about privacy and security protections. As an opportunity, offer support for and education of technology users regarding privacy and security protections, including for health and other information shared on social media. As a high-tech activity recommendation, we can identify educational approaches, technology mitigators, and potential regulatory solutions that offer improved privacy and security protections and really help keep patients and consumers safe and secure. Next slide. Another item with privacy and security, we noticed a distinct variability in information sharing policies across the states. As an opportunity, we note that there could be an increased uniformity of information sharing policies across states. As an activity for us to consider, we should consider the federal role in setting guidelines for the exchange of data across states. Next slide. Another item around privacy and security is the variability in adoption of cybersecurity frameworks. As an opportunity, offer support for widespread adoption of cybersecurity frameworks. And then as a recommended high-tech activity, consider the impact of nationwide adoption of cybersecurity frameworks and delineate cybersecurity accountability for data by role. As it stands today, there's a number of entities that exchange data, and sometimes it's very hard to parse out where does the buck stop when it comes to an item around privacy and security. So that's what we mean by accountability for data by role. Next slide. As in other privacy and security area, key gap is lack of user control to share and disclose information. As an opportunity, consider the options for granular levels of consent to share and disclose information. As a high-tech activity recommendation, we could undertake a review of emerging consent approaches and the technologies that underpin them and make recommendations for the improvement of current consent approaches. Next slide. And I'm going to turn this one back to Carolyn. Keep going.
Great. Thanks, Aaron. To give you a change in voice here, the key gap that we identified is an unmet infrastructure need for underserved populations. And the key opportunity that goes along with that is to support infrastructure needs for underserved populations, including exchange costs, the prevalence of electronic equipment, internet access, pharmacy services, and use of telehealth services. Our recommended high-tech activity in this area is to measure the impact of the monetization of data exchange. Next slide, please. So continuing in patient access, another key gap is accessibility and usability of patient portals and other patient-facing technology continue to need improvement. So our opportunity is to consider improvements to accessibility and usability of patient portals and other patient-facing technology. And our recommended high-tech activity is to measure the amount or length of time that a portal has been online working properly, patient engagement, and or patient understanding and use of data. Next slide, please. Another key gap is patient awareness and education about health IT resources. So for us, a key opportunity would be to encourage patient and caregiver education about health IT resources. Our recommended high-tech activity is to identify use cases demonstrating the value of patient data to the patient. Next slide, please. So we've gone through all of the landscape and gap analysis. We've identified some key issues and opportunities and made a few recommendations. And now we'd like to move into the discussion. Next slide, please. I think rather than going back through the slides and all of the priority target areas, in the interest of time and trying to ensure that we have a chance to hear everyone's comments, we will just take an open discussion with questions, comments, or thoughts about what else we need to add to the report to make it complete. And I'll ask Robert to call on people to give us questions and comments.
This is Lauren. I see Denise has a hand up.
Yep. Thank you, Carolyn and Aaron. I thought the report was really well written and had some good details. The one area I do have some questions about, though, was the last part you covered about recommendations for addressing health IT infrastructure gaps. On a number of the recommended high-tech activities, it says, for instance, consider the federal role in setting guidelines for the exchange of data across state. I'm trying to envision what consider means. Are we suggesting that we make some recommendations on the federal role in setting guidelines, and that would be the activity of our committee? And I would reflect the same similar comment on the next item where we said consider the impact of nationwide adoption. Again, are we suggesting that we're going to work on that activity to make recommendations? So I was looking for some clarification there, and then I have just a couple other comments. I'll start with that one.
Okay. Thanks, Denise. In the preparation of the report and the slides, we came to understand from ONC that there are some terminology standards in terms of the way things are phrased. And consider is one of the ways that government likes to approach language because it's quite broad and it gives us some latitude in terms of what we do. Really, in terms of the high-tech making recommendations or trying to define its work, we have quite a bit of latitude. We could, for example, do a review of approaches or the ways that various government action is being implemented now and make suggestions. We could take a more focused and prescribing approach, saying we think that ONC and or other agencies need to do X, Y, and Z. We really have quite a bit of latitude, and that is something for high tech to talk about and consider what we think is valuable in terms of addressing the work that is laid out in 21st Century Cures and our mandate, as well as what would be valuable going forward, taking into account the health IT infrastructure in the U.S. and what we will be doing this year with the NPRM and other work. Do you have thoughts, Aaron?
No, I think you hit the nail on the head. The other component I would offer to folks is, as we look at it, try to take a step back and see how high tech can also even bring conversation to the forefront to say, hey, we need to think about the implications of not making considerations from a federal perspective, and what, you know, sometimes just the conversation, sometimes even suggestions or guidance could really help set a standard for, okay, folks are going to adopt a level playing field of X, Y, and Z, so that there's not such a non-uniformity, non-conformity across state lines. And in the case of privacy and security, you have certain states that are really blazing the trail and going to the nth degree around the privacy considerations, and you have others that are still considering and debating those discussions. So what happens to the providers that potentially cross state lines, or for those patients across state lines, if we don't say something, if we don't make considerations? So just think of it that way.
Thank you. And I just have one other question under the priority target area for patient access to information. There's an example under here, for example, measure the impact of clinical grade data collected by patients on testing costs. What testing are we referring to here in our report? Is this lab testing, procedural testing?
I'm trying to find exactly what page. What page are you on? I'm sorry.
It's under the bullet of just before the conclusion. Just before suggestions for additional high tech initiatives, and it's a for example, measure the impact of clinical grade data collected by patients on testing costs. Is that testing of software, testing of tools? I'm not sure what testing we're referring to.
Yeah, would we go ahead, Carolyn.
I was thinking that in that situation we were thinking about tests that might be performed in the lab, for example. There are now some heart rate monitors available to consumers that are actually the same grade as what is used in cardiac rehab labs. You know, for example, a person has a heart attack and they get into a cardiac rehab program, and they will wear certain types of heart rate monitors when they go in to do the walking protocol or whatever the exercise training is that's intended to help them build back cardiac strength. There was a time when those
You're referring to clinical testing then. Maybe we should add the word clinical on clinical testing costs.
Yes, we can make that change.
Yeah, it was a good suggestion. And also, there were a number of excellent physician stories and others that Brett gave us, who is a practicing physician at Baptist, as it feeds into this. And he noted extensively how this was impacting provider workflow and overall ability to provide care, given the variability of costs on the clinical side.
Thanks. Thanks for that clarification.
Sure, and we can certainly add additional text there to make that clearer, if that would be helpful.
Any other comments or questions or thoughts for the annual report?
I would offer that I know it's a lot of information, and the slide deck doesn't do the justice of the actual report itself that was sent out for you guys to read and read through. Please look it over. Send us emails, questions, comments, whatnot. I know several of you already have. I'll say I really kudos to Stephen Lane and others who have. We really appreciate that. Take a chance to really think through it, right? This is our opportunity to really guide the following years of upcoming work and to really help reinforce what's going on across the health IT landscape.
And I'd like to reiterate my support for your sending us feedback and helping us to refine this and provide, put into words and concrete the direction that you would like to see high tech go in the coming year and perhaps years beyond that, in terms of what we contribute to the health IT infrastructure in the U.S. We will be in the annual report work group. We'll be meeting on March 1st, where we would like to start working with the feedback we receive from all of you. So I would ask again that you send us by email all your comments and thoughts by the end of your day, say midnight on February 27th. That's a week from now. that will give us a chance to collate all those comments in a chart to ensure that we make changes or respond to each one, and then to be able to present that chart showing all of your comments and questions and how we've addressed each one of them at our March meeting. We realize this is a significant document to read and to process, particularly as we go into the NPRM work, but we feel it's really valuable for our group in terms of being able to go forward with meaningful activities. And we want to be able to bring this back to you in a way that is completely transparent, so everyone can see what we've done and how we've worked to address the concerns and really make this a document that represents the views and interests and goals of this HITECH committee, not just of a small subset.
Carolyn, which email address do we send the comments to?
Lauren, what would be the preferred address?
It's the onc.hitech email.
Okay, great.
We can send that around to everyone.
This is Clem McDonald. I'm a little bit limited in my ability to interact because I'm in a double meeting, but I just wanted to say that the statement about unstructured, I just want to make sure you don't mean it totally as nothing structured. I think you're really just talking about the payload as narrative, because unstructured means you wouldn't know who the person was, you wouldn't know the date, you wouldn't be able to deliver it to anyone. So I think just be careful about that word unstructured in the document.
Thank Great you. Point. Great point.
This is Ken Kamoto. Sorry, I don't have my hand up, but could I ask a question?
Sure. Go ahead, Ken.
Sure, go ahead, Tim.
Great. Could I ask for the privacy and security whether the annual report task force considered the current state of affairs with the fire and OWASP? Specification, just verifying that sending, for example, patient name, et cetera, when you don't actually need to, or providing access to external business associates, lab data, et cetera, they don't actually need access to, is HIPAA compliant. I think it'd be very useful if we can get a determination that is, in fact, HIPAA compliant.
So I can jump in on this one. So we did talk in some discussion about some of the previous. Remember, we're focused here on 2018, right? What occurred in 2018, and a lot of things were pending by December 31st of 2018 that's now come out. So we did discuss some of the work that was done in the previous FACAs around in the Health IT Standards and Health IT Policy Committee, as well as all the recommendations from like the API FACA and others, which go right back to your point. I know that OCR and others participated heavily in those, so there's a lot of documentation there, which we do reference in our appendix. But as for your specific question, no, and the reason for that is because the information blocking rule and others had not come out, and we didn't want to suddenly go into an area that, you know, potentially we'd have to work through when that's really a 2019 report item. That all being said, we're happy to look at that and see if there's other dimensionality we could speak to address that.
Okay, I mean, if it's more appropriate to discuss in, say, the 2019, that's fine. I just want to make sure that what in practice we're doing is covered. I think it probably is, but I have never heard explicitly it is. I just wanted to make sure we were covered in what's going on in practice.
Yep, got it. We'll look at it. Thank you.
Okay, thanks. Thanks.
Okay, any other thoughts or feedback on the annual report? Okay, Carolyn, I'll hand it back to you for any, just to wrap up this presentation before we move on.
Okay, thanks, Lauren. I just want to reiterate our hope that you will share any feedback, questions, concerns, or fan mail with the annual report work group by midnight on February 27th. And again, to thank my work group colleagues, Erin, Christina, Chesley, and Brett, and to let you know we appreciate being able to bring this to you. Thank you.
All right, so I think that just about wraps up, you know, our two major agenda items, looking at the proposed rule and the annual report. I know it was quite a bit to digest today, so again, if you have any additional questions on the task force, on the rule, I'm sure those will be addressed once the task force activity kicks off. So with that, I'm just going to go for one last call for questions or thoughts before we open it up for public comment.
Hi, this is Ken. Just a quick comment. If we are finished early and after the public comment compared to schedule, I wonder if initial discussion on the NPRM, et cetera, might be worthwhile. Otherwise, I think we'll just do it in our task forces, but it seems like we might be ahead of schedule.
Yep, we are a little bit ahead of schedule. Robert and Carolyn,
Ken, did you have a comment? Ken, did you have a particular comment you wanted to make about the proposed rule?
Sure. I mean, I have a number related to the APIs, but would this be the right time, or would it be after we go to public comment and see how much time we have left after that?
We have about 15 minutes before we had scheduled the public comment period, so I think there's a little bit of room here if you want to start the conversation. If we have to break for the 12:45 promised time for public comment, then we can take a break and come back to it.
Okay, so maybe I'll start with one. I noticed that the API requirements were around Argonaut and not the US CoreFire profiles. Assuming that was intentional, one comment question is, why Argonaut rather than US CoreFire profile, since Argonaut is not a public open group? It is membership only and really a closed membership group of just a select number of companies and healthcare organizations.
Is Steve still online?
Sure. Yeah. Hey, this is Steve. Can you hear me?
Yep.
Yes.
All right. Cool. Sorry for the latency. So Ken, in answering your question, we canvassed the ecosystem for the implementation guidance that would be available to support a proposal associated with Fire Release 2, which is what we proposed. The U.S. Fire Corps profiles, as you may be familiar, were first identified in the HL7 space attributed to Fire Release 3. And so because our full suite of proposals centered around where the industry was today, which is associated with Fire Release 2, we looked at the full suite of implementation guidance that is available, and we also look at market-driven consortia standards or implementation guidance that is available and open to the public to use, of which the Argonaut specifications are a part for Fire Release 2. That being said, we do have a detailed discussion in the rule identifying the various fire, you know, standards versions that are out as the base standard and the accompanying implementation guidance that's available and for which we request comments. So we identified, you know, Fire Release 3 was available. That was one of the options that I covered earlier in terms of if we were to adopt, you know, kind of quote paraphrasing what we've referenced in the preamble, if we were to adopt in a final rule Fire Release 3, we would also adopt the accompanying implementation guidance that would be associated with it, which would be Fire US Core Release 3 version implementation guidance or profiles, which are the next evolution of Argonaut, just for people to have as a full context. So for Fire Release 2, there is the Argonaut profiles. Then for Fire Release 3, the Argonaut profiles were folded into what we call the U.S. Fire Corps profiles. And so for Fire Release 4, our expectation is, as since that was just published, you know, a month or so ago, there will be a turn of the crank to have updated Fire Release 4 U.S. Fire Corps profiles that will effectively be, you know, the second evolution of the original Argonaut profiles. So hopefully that answers your question.
Yeah, and I think it'll just be a point that we comment on. I think just as a matter of process, yes, Argonaut,
does lead into U.S. Corps, but then it goes into a formal balloting process where people can provide comments. Argonaut really is a members only, where EHR vendors that are not a part of that group, healthcare systems that are not a part of that group, have exactly zero say in how that goes. So I think that would be potentially problematic to set national standards around something that has really no potential for public comment.
Ken, do you have other comments about APIs?
Sure. Another comment question was, I think it's really bold and great to focus on cost-only API access. I guess a question around that. It seems very different from any other app store model. For example, I guess it would be the equivalent of the iTunes store or the Google Play store, where the, you know, Apple or Google don't make money based on a percentage of revenue, but it's more just the cost of hosting the app. It would be interesting, or maybe just a question, is it based on interpretation of the information blocking in terms of, like, that's regulatorily required, or was it based on any other thoughts? I mean, as a healthcare system and, you know, developing these kind of things, that sounds great, but it seems like potentially could significantly reduce the incentives for EHR vendors to further develop these ecosystems, and also potentially have unintended consequences for things like, you know, things that people want to make available for free, because now it's going to be on the same costing structure as things that people are otherwise trying to make money on. And in a sense, in the current approaches, maybe getting subsidized by that so that a public bid can be transmitted. So I think of things like, you know, if the federal government, like the CDC, wanted to make recommendations and value-add applications available to everyone and make those available for free, it may still cost healthcare systems a substantial amount of money to pay for the API costs, because they're on the same footing to install those as a for-profit app.
Guess I'll go for it. This is Mike Lipinski. I will try to provide you a response. I'll just say, caveat it with, I cannot probably in my response synthesize all of our laid out justification that, you know, took hundreds of pages as to our approach here. But I will recite some of what we said. And so first, you know, starting off with the evidence that we have, that we cited in the congressional report to Congress, and that we had through stakeholder interactions, including when we were taking information in with joint meetings with the OIG to inform this rulemaking, fees were still the number one way to, I don't say number one way, one of the main ways to prohibit the access to EHI. So Congress, and we say that our we include fees as our interpretation as a means to information block. And I think, you know, as we say in the rule, we see and EHI as not a commodity that can be traded or sold just by the custodians of the EHI, just because of that simple fact, and they have the control and access to the EHI. And so, relying on the broad, I'll call it a prohibition. It's technically not a prohibition. It's saying, here's what information blocking is, and if you do it, here are the consequences, including up to a $1 million penalty per instance of found to be information blocking. But, so with that in mind, we didn't think there should be any fees associated with the access, use, and exchange of EHI. However, to your points, we believe through our exceptions, we have provided a proper basis to recover those, you know, reasonably incurred costs and promote innovation and competition. So just as an example, building out an API, that is a cost that, can be recovered. Including profit, as we discuss in the preamble, related to that. Similarly, if you came up with a unique way to do something and obtained, and then you obtained intellectual property rights in it, we do not say that you can't benefit or profit from that. So we just suggest, we propose that those the approach to that is that you would have to license that IP on RAND terms. So that ensures that the access is still maintained to the EHI. However, it is still promoting innovation. It is still allowing the ability to recover a cost and make a profit on innovation. And to that point, when it comes to something unique and novel, we say and note that that is something that's considered when determining whether something are reasonable and necessary, reasonable and non-discriminatory terms regarding licensing. So we think that we put forth an approach that addresses your concerns. We found that, you know, that some of those things like rent seeking, royalties to get access were ways to inhibit the access to information. And again, to our initial premise about it not being a commodity for trading and selling, as we discuss in the rule, we took this approach. However, obviously, it is a proposed rule. We welcome comments. If you think there is a better way to address the concerns that we've identified related to information blocking, we are, I think, all ears to that and welcome comments. Hope that provides some more insight.
Yeah, it does. I think maybe the simple question would be, it'd be great to get an example from another industry where the model worked. I mean, I personally really like it. I'm just worried about how the EHR vendors will react in terms of their investment into this ecosystem. Because like the app store, I think the whole notion of things like, you know, smart apps, et cetera, that arose out of the idea of, hey, look how successful these smartphone apps stores are. Let's try to replicate in healthcare. And this would really change that model. So I assume there's some other industry where this kind of model has worked and the ecosystem is flourished, but I'm just not aware of it. So I think it'd be useful if, like, we have an example we can look to and say, hey, yeah, this is what we want to do, because this approach I think we're heading towards would mean it no longer would be really equivalent to, like, you know, an Apple or Google App Store kind of model.
Yeah, Ken, this is Steve. Just to perhaps add on to what Mike noted, and he was saying it, I think, implied in a way. The important thing to remember as the overall context is that in comparison to other industries, there hasn't necessarily been a law like the 21st Century Cures Act with the definitiveness and specificity of both the actors covered, the type of behaviors that would be prohibited, you know, for which civil monetary penalties are applied, as well as in the API conditions of certification paradigm, a statutory, a law requirement for APIs to be published, and that they be done in a manner that can, for which they can be used without special effort. And so there are a lot of, unique characteristics of the environment in which we find ourselves from a health IT perspective that are admittedly different in comparison to other industries where they have a different competitive landscape and different business motivators to make APIs accessible and things of that nature. And so I think it's really helpful to look, and we've certainly done so in the past couple of years as we were putting these proposals together, at other industries, how they're being deployed. You know, we've looked at how maps, you know, map APIs is an example, which is an easy one, you know, for a kind of a lay audience to wrap your head around, and various other spaces. And so certainly if members of the HITECH have other industry experience where, you know, we can take that into consideration. And like Mike said, we're all ears. But again, just from a statutory perspective, there are some differences that Congress, you know, as Dr. Rucker mentions, right, like close to unanimously passed law in both chambers, that Congress has specifically provided us to implement and execute as part of the law.
Yeah, and yeah, just one more point on that I think Steve helped me think about and point out in, as an overarching thing, and it, this is what Elise did too. So you have to always start from the perspective of you should be sharing in all instances unless required by law not to, right? That's the way the statute reads. And it's really a likely interference, right? So it's not even you had to have interfered. It's a your action, your practice would likely interfere with the access exchange and use. So our goal was to try to provide, you know, however you want to, we call them exceptions, safe harbors, to where you could do certain actions that would inhibit access exchange and use, but would be acceptable under the circumstances. And one obviously was we wanted to promote innovation, competition. So we wanted to be able to, you could recover certain costs related to promoting that access exchange and use, including a profit, as I mentioned, and as mentioned in the preamble. So that's kind of where we came from to set it up. Again, and as you know, we looked at, we did a lot of research, a lot of stakeholder feedback. If you don't think this is the right approach, or if you think it could have some negative unintended consequences, again, we're looking for that comment on that. So thanks.
Ken, do you have anything else?
I don't want to hog the conversation if the others have comments. I mean, otherwise, I have a few more. But
yeah, I think what we're going to do is go right to the public comment period at 12:45 as scheduled, and then we'll certainly ask others if they have comments after the public comments. But I wanted to give you one last bite at the apple here before we go.
Sure. Did I understand correctly with the one-day verification? It's saying like I understand. So for example, if we have provider-facing smart apps or CDS hook services, whatever's covered, that we create, instead of going through the current vendor-based review process for security, et cetera, that according to these proposed regs, one day later, it must be available to healthcare systems who want access, even if it hasn't been vetted by the vendor. Did I understand that right?
I think to help you understand if you understand it, it would be helpful to lay out the entire sequence of events, because that one day thing is the end of the sequence. So this has to do with app registration. And if a health IT developer is in the position of registering the apps, they have a choice. They can just automatically register the apps through whatever mechanism that they want to do. And, you know, dynamic client registration protocol is one of those that, you know, numerous folks in the industry have talked about as a mechanism, you know, where that handshake and registration can just occur in kind of an ad hoc way, you know, in I don't want to say in real time, but for lack of a better word. The other, in deference to some of the market concerns that we've heard, we included a permissive process that helped IT developers, in this case, API technology suppliers, saying that they could institute a app developer authenticity verification process, right? So you can verify that this is not a bot, this is not some, you know, they can verify who the other person is on the other end. And we lay out some examples of the type of documentation that they could require. In keeping with the without special effort kind of construct, we said if an API technology supplier were to implement this type of authenticity verification approach, they would have up to 5 business days to complete that authenticity review. At the point in time when they completed that review, the one-day part kicks in as part of their maintenance and certification requirements. So we didn't want there to be like a slow-walking kind of event where they complete the authenticity review, but then they don't, you know, the API technology supplier, for whatever reason, doesn't get the application registered in a timely manner afterwards. And so that's the one-day thing of like once they complete their authenticity review and, you know, the thumbs up, then the app should be in the registration, you know, listing or what have you within that one day. Does that help? They don't have to do it at all. So if they don't do it at all, then they're going to have some means of dynamically registering, you know, or ad hoc registration at the time that an app comes in.
But that makes sense. And just to clarify, that is very different from what's currently happening, and that's intentional, I'm assuming.
Hey guys, I just want to comment that we have, to Lisa's point, this is a pretty meaty rule, and we have 4 work groups that are going to dive in detail. I'm not sure that we can adjudicate every aspect of the proposed rules in before public comment in this session. So just a suggestion for the chairs.
Thanks. And also, this is Robert again, I don't mean to be overly strict about this, but I feel an obligation that since we publicized that the public comment period will be at 12:45, that we honor that promise to them. And so anybody who has been waiting patiently to comment would have the opportunity to. So on the slide, you see the dial-in comment number, and there's also an email if the public wishes to email comments in. But at this point, I'm going to turn it over to Lauren to manage the public comment period. Is that all right?
Great. That's perfect. Thank you, Robert. Operator, can you please open the line for public comment?
Certainly. If you'd like to make a public comment, please press star 1 on your telephone keypad. A confirmation tone will indicate your line is in the question queue, and you may press star 2 if you'd like to remove your comment from the queue. For participants using speaker equipment, it may be necessary to pick up your handset before pressing the star keys. Again, that is star 1 for public comment at this time.
Thank you. And just a reminder for those public commenters, we'll ask you to keep your responses to no more than 3 minutes. And operator, do we have any comments in the queue at this time?
We do. We have comments from the line of Mary Savekas with Chime.
Thank you. Please go ahead.
Thanks, everyone. Hi, thanks, everyone. This is Mari Savickas with Chime. A huge thanks to ONC and to CMS on the rules. Absolutely an enormous lift. Just wanted to actually had questions, which I know are hard to answer on a federal advisory committee, but wanted to find out if there was any information forthcoming regarding educational webinars so we could get that information out to our members. Also, if there's an opportunity for people who are outside of the high tech to participate on the task force. I wasn't totally clear about that, and it sounds like they're getting started next week. So if any more information on that could be made available, that would be helpful. And then last but not least, just want to echo the comment that Denise Webb made regarding the deadlines for the rules. And while we appreciate that they haven't been published in final format, we've gotten a lot of feedback from our members that more time will be needed. And it's such a meaty rule, especially the ONC one, that we're really going to need a lot of time to get through that. So thank you very much for taking our comment.
So this is Lauren. I can just want to be clear in regards to the question about the educational webinars. Is that relative to the committee's materials?
Mari, this is Elise. I'm guessing that that's in relation to ONC's general work and not the high tech, but please clarify and then we can answer either way.
Yes, I mean, just general overview for the public regarding the rule, which is not specific to high tech, but my question around the task force is specific to high tech.
Okay, well, I'll do the webinar one, then I'll turn it back to you, Lauren, for the task forces. So in terms of the webinars, yes, as folks know, we always try to make sure there's as much engagement as possible. We will be having a series of webinars for the general public around pieces in the rule. There'll be more than one. We're working on finalizing the dates for those, but those should be upcoming, hopefully starting next week. But we will definitely publicize those online so folks have it. In the interim, just want to reiterate that even though the rule is not included, has not been published in the Federal Register as yet. It is currently online on our website at healthit.gov/NPRM. If there's any changes to the rule when it's published, it will be small changes. It will not be substantive changes. So what you have on the website is what ONC is going out with in terms of the proposals. Also on the website, there's a number of infographics and fact sheets that we've included that lay out different sections of the rule. And I think as Steve noted earlier, our goal is to provide a quick, relatively easy to read resource for you to take a quick look at the sections of the rule that can allow you to dig deeper at a later time of your choosing on the full depth of the scope of the rule. But we will publish the webinar dates and times on that website. And I would encourage folks to, those who are interested, to sign up quickly because those tend to fill up pretty quickly.
Great, and thanks, Elise. Yeah, and just to clarify, on healthit.gov/high-tech, on the landing page there's a button for membership application, and that is where you can apply for future task forces. So you will see the task forces that we've laid out today are included in the drop-down menu. I will mention if you've already submitted an application, no need to submit it again. We have it within the database, so only if you have not completed an application previously. Operator, do we have any other public comments?
Not at this time.
Okay. I will turn it back to Robert and Carolyn.
Thanks, Lauren. So we have just a couple of minutes left, and appreciate Ken's comments about the API and Aaron's also that we're not going to try to litigate the entire rule in one call, but I wanted to make sure that the HITECH committee had an opportunity to make comments or seek clarification on anything we talked about today in terms of the proposed rule or the annual report. So anyone who has comments or questions or clarifying questions, now would be the time to get them in. I see some public comments by Clem and Sasha. If you wanted to ask those online, you can do that at this point as well.
So this is Sasha, and the comment that I had, and I respecting, I guess, Arian's feedback that we shouldn't get too into the weeds in this context, but as Steve was describing the process for optionally verifying application developers, one question I've heard stakeholders starting to ask is if there is no verification of application developers, is there a clarity around there not being liability for any subsequent consequences that might result from automated or the decision not to perform that verification?
I think that's a really important point that Sasha's bringing up and something that we would very much appreciate feedback on in terms of where, you know, areas like that where we can hopefully provide clarity as part of a final rule. Because it may be things that are other federal agencies with whom we need to work with to provide some of that clarity too.
Great. Other comments, questions?
It's Don, especially a comment, yeah. We're reaching out to the Office of Civil Rights because they actually do a lot of the HIPAA right of access, which would address that question.
Thank you.
All right. Anything else? All right. Well, certainly, Carolyn and I would like to thank the ONC and CMS for relatively quickly going through 700-plus pages here for everybody. And I want to thank Carolyn and Aaron and their committee on the annual report. As noted, this is a critical report coming from our committee, and we hope everyone has a chance to review it and will provide their thoughtful comments to us before our next meeting, which is our face-to-face meeting in March. It's also worth noting, as was already said, that the federal government closed today in Washington, D.C. because of snow, and so all of our federal members are trying to do this work telecommuting, and that's appreciated as well.
On behalf of the
Lauren,
ONC, it's our pleasure. We're happy to do it.
I would say, Lauren, if we can make sure that there was a previous mailing about the task forces that went out to the HITECH, if perhaps you can remail that again now that the presentation has been made. I think that might be helpful for the committee again, the one that outlined the different task forces that are being stood up and the links as well.
Sure. Yep. We'll get that out right after the call while it's fresh in everyone's memory. And then, Robert, just
yep.
As you mentioned, our next in-person meeting is on March 19th and 20th. We've actually added a day to make it a two-day in-person meeting, which is certainly timely so that we can continue to have these discussions relative to the rule and the report in person. So if you have not responded to the email concerning travel and accommodations, please do that as well. And I will send out the email regarding the task forces. Carolyn, any other closing remarks?
It's just a thanks to our ONC colleagues for giving us such a detailed overview of the provisions of the work we're about to undertake and information about the task forces. As Robert and Lauren have said, I strongly encourage everyone to let us know today what task force or forces you're interested in, as we do want to get the work underway with our 60-day deadline on the horizon. The annual report work group looks forward to your feedback about that report, and we'll be happy to get together next month. See you all then.
Looking forward to seeing everybody in person.
Great.
Have a great rest of the week.
Thank you. We'll adjourn. Thank you. Bye-bye.